Welcome. It's nice to have you here. I'm so glad you could come. This is going to be such an exciting day. I hope you enjoy it. I think you will.
Clearly, folks, we're in some tough economic times. But finally, after months and months of dark clouds, there is some good news.
A stunning turnaround by the banking giant Goldman Sachs.
$3.4 billion in earnings in the past 3 months' time.
Goldman Sachs is on track to pay out as much as $20 billion in bonuses, $700,000 per employee, more than 14 times the average American household income.
Woohoo! We're back! Yes! You hear that? That is the sound of raw capitalism stampeding. Goldman Sachs makes $3.4 billion in profit from April to June. I guess the bailouts are working for Goldman Sachs. How is it happening? Well, it's simple. Let me explain. The U.S. economy is basically a pyramid. And it's taken some real hits lately. Unemployment is at a 26-year high. 6.5 million jobs have been lost. 1.9 million house foreclosure filings just this year. And consumer confidence is at an all-time low. All economic indicators that have left the beloved top of our pyramid, the I, Goldman Sachs, in peril. Because everyone who studies pyramids knows you must always protect the pyramid's eye. Pyramids can survive the loss of the foundation, but once they get poked in the eye... Anyway, that's where the government came in. First, they let a couple of Goldman Sachs' competitors, like Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns, collapse or be absorbed. That can't be bad for Goldman's business. Then, we gave AIG $13 billion so they could pay back, 100 cents on the dollar, the $13 billion they owed Goldman Sachs for the bets Goldman Sachs had made that AIG insured. Then we let Goldman Sachs become a holding bank and gave them $28 billion in loan guarantees to keep their cost of capital down. It's what's known in business as the invisible government-funded scaffolding of the free market. And it worked! Just enough for Goldman Sachs to pay its employees a total of $11.36 billion so far this year. So fret not, America! Your work has not gone in vain. We can all rest assured that... Wait, what's happening? Is there... No, the supports are giving out! Quick! Everybody, throw your bodies under Goldman Sachs to cushion its fall! Children first! They're the softest!
You get nothing! You lose! Good day, sir!
Gonna rise up, take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution.
This Week in Radical History, for the week starting July 20th, is produced from the mobile fortress of Glee Glee Studios. Thanks to the Slingshot organizer, the Daily Bleed website, and the Radio Roots crew from WBAI in New York for supplying material you're about to hear.
Little surprises around every corner, but nothing dangerous.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
Week in Radical History for July 20th, we only have a couple items. 1848, the Declaration of Sentiments begin the women's suffrage movement in New York. Also on July 20th, 1874, General Custer and his first official exploration expedition enters the Black Hills with 150 wagons and 1,000 men in direct violation of the Treaty of 1869 that barred whites from the Sacred Hills. Treaties? What treaties? We're the U.S. government. We don't abide by any treaties. Also on July 20th, 1944, German officer plots to kill Adolf Hitler and staged a coup. Colonel Klaus von Stauffenberg left a briefcase concealing a bomb at Hitler's feet during a meeting. The bomb killed four people, but a table leg shielded Hitler. Also on July 20th, 1997, Honduras, announcement of more mass graves of leftists found in military sites by the U.S.-backed government. Lastly, on July 20th, 2001, Carlo Gollini, a 23-year-old Italian activist and anarchist, dies during a demonstration against the G8 summit in Genoa. Gollini was killed in a clash between protesters and Italian military police, who shot him and then ran over his body with a jeep. This week in radical history, starting July 21st, 1916, U.S. Marines land in Haiti again to protect American interests. They'll go back again and again as well, the U.S. having a lot of interests to protect.
The men and women in our armed forces protect our borders and our people, not the financial interests of Folgers, Chiquita Banana, Exxon, and Halliburton. These are not isolated incidents of stupidity. They're part of a long, bloody history of foreign policy being conducted for the financial interests of the wealthy few.
Also on July 21st, 1954, the Geneva Accords are signed, ending the French colonization of French Indochina, a place also known as Vietnam. The U.S. discovering that the French might not be interested, but by God, the U.S. must have some special interest in Vietnam. Within a year, they'll have their first military advisors setting the stage for the Vietnam War. Also on July 1st, 1972, George Carlin is charged with disorderly conduct for performing his famous Seven Words Act in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
There are two things that I blame for the abysmal condition of this magnificent species that had such potential at one time, and that is religion and commerce. And those are the two things that hinder us here. I mean, the religious people say this is immoral, it is corrupting, and it will do bad things to your character if you even hear these words as a child or a grown-up or whatever. And commerce says if you say these things, the customers and the advertisers are going to run from you.
This week in radical history for July 22nd.
On this day, July 22nd, in 1863, American frontiersman Kit Carson was ordered by the military governor of New Mexico to get rid of the entire Navajo Nation. At first, Carson was shocked by the brutal nature of this plan and attempted to resign his position. But after being pressured to stay, he obediently began the forced removal of the Navajo people from their land. First, Carson and his men implemented a scorched earth policy, burning Navajo fields and homes and stealing their livestock. Carson then began attacking the Navajo strongholds that fought in resistance until the Navajo were forced to surrender. A few months later, 8,000 Navajos were forced to march 300 miles to Fort Sumner, where they were imprisoned for the next 4 years. Over 300 people died during the long walk, and many more died in imprisonment. This is just one of the many brutal atrocities committed against indigenous populations in the land of the free.
Also on July 22, 1938, Joe Louis defeats German boxer Max Schmeling. Because of the Nazi persecution of the Jews in Europe and Hitler's disdain for blacks, the fight had a mystic proportions, with Louis seen by many as fighting to uphold democracy and the race. He succeeded convincingly, ending the fight in the first round. Also on July 22, 1970, during the Alcatraz occupation by Indians of all tribes, the first child was born on the first freed Native American piece of land in the 20th century. Also on this date in 1995 in Israel, four foreign activists break padlocks and reopen the main gates to the Palestinian Hebron University in the West Bank, closed by Israeli security and occupation forces back in 1987.
On this day, July 23rd, in 1846, writer and philosopher Henry David Thoreau was thrown in jail for refusing to pay his $1 poll tax in protest of American slavery and the Mexican-American War. Thoreau had resisted his poll tax for 6 years because he did not support the government's use of the money. Although he was only in jail for one night, the experience deeply impacted him, and he began speaking out about the responsibility of individuals to hold their government accountable. 3 years later, Thoreau wrote Civil Disobedience, an essay explaining how the actions of the American government were controlled by only a few individuals rather than the people. Thoreau's essay was highly influential to many activists.
Also on this day, July 23rd, 1892, strikers battled Pinkerton thugs during the Carnegie Steel Strike in Homestead, Pennsylvania, as the Pinkertons, trying to import and protect scabs, opened fire on striking steel workers. In the ensuing battle, three Pinkertons and 11 Strikers and spectators are shot dead. Strikers militantly resisted the private goons hired by Henry Clay Frick to dislodge him from the plant grounds. They fought back with guns and homemade cannon. The strike, however, lasted for 4 months, but the company was able to restore production as winter approached and morale declined. Anarchist Alexander Berkman, on this day, would enter Frick's office and shoot him, trying to revenge the deaths of the strikers. As a side note, later in the year, Emma Goldman would horsewhip her old mentor, Johann Maust, for shit-talking Berkman's attempt. She horsewhipped him on stage and broke the whip afterwards. Also on July 23, 1908, Nazi sympathizer and anti-Semite Henry Ford would sell his first Model T. On July 30, 1938, Hitler presented the highest non-citizen award, Grand Cross the Supreme Order of the German Eagle, to Henry Ford in Berlin. U.S. Senate reports in 1974 on Ford Motor Company's aid to Nazi war effort. Have you driven your Ford in support of the Nazis lately? Also on July 23, 1967, starts out of Detroit upheavals, 7 days of social unrest, fighting with cops, anti-business, anti-government actions, including looting, results in 43 dead, 2,000 wounded, and 5,000 made homeless. Largest U.S. riots in a century, sparks additional riots throughout the United States. Also on this date in 1968, police kill 7 in standoff with black nationalists in Cleveland, Ohio, triggering days of riots and 4 more deaths. Lastly, on July 23, 2004, preemptive harassment as FBI and Joint Terrorism Task Force investigate infoshops and anarchists throughout the country. In Lawrence, Columbia, Kirksville, Topeka, and St. Louis, agents served several anarchists with subpoenas, ordering them to report to the grand jury on the same day they were planning to go to Boston to protest the Democratic National Convention. Let freedom ring. This day in radical history for July 24th, labor organizer Mary Harris Mother Jones begins the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Theodore Roosevelt Summer Hole in Oyster Bay, Long Island, New York, to publicize the harsh conditions of child labor in Philadelphia textile mills. When Mother Jones first visited Philadelphia, she found child workers as young as 10-year-old with stooped shoulders and missing fingers and hands. In response, she organized the march. Mary Harris Mother Jones led striking children from Kennington Textile Mills in Pennsylvania on a 17-day march from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, where they hoped to confront Roosevelt in his summer home. About 300 men, women, and children were led by 3 children dressed as Revolutionary War soldiers. Along the way, they raised awareness of child laborers with rallies in eastern Pennsylvania, New York, and New Jersey, and won the hearts of many. When Mother Jones and her army arrived in Coney Island, she was asked to speak. The result of the speech was The Wail of the Children, which was delivered today. When they reached Oyster Bay on July 29th, where Teddy Roosevelt was vacationing, he refused to see them. Our beloved Teddy Roosevelt would be quoted as saying, "The worst foe of the poor man is labor leaders, who tries to teach him that he is the victim of conspiracy and injustice." Of course, the children would have problems reading these reports in the newspapers, since they're often kept illiterate and had no fingers for turning the pages. Also on this day, July 24th, 1925, John T. Scopes, convicted in Tennessee of teaching evolution in high school, fined $100 and costs for monkeying around. Also on this date in 1950, German V-2 became the first rocket to be launched at Cape Canaveral, Florida. Big surprise, as the U.S. provided safe haven for thousands of Nazis following World War II, including known war criminals and hundreds of scientists who developed the Nazi-German rocket program. In the U.S. intelligence, there was no prohibition for hiring anyone in the Gestapo or SS, historians said. This was a don't-ask-don't-tell culture. Also on this date in 1974, House Judicial Committee debates Nixon's articles of impeachment, including obstruction of justice, abuse of presidential powers, using CIA, FBI, and IRS and other federal agencies to violate civilian constitutional rights and to create the Plumbers Group to engage in illegal acts, as well as failure to supply subpoenaed material to the committee. Failure to turn over subpoenaed materials. Same crimes, different times. Lastly on this date in 1983, women tag U.S. warplanes with graffiti at Greenham Commons in England. This week in Radical History for July 25th, 1648 in New World, York County Court upholds authority of colonists to kill on site any free Indians they see in settled areas. Also on July 25th, 1930, a white mob threatens to hang ranchers employing Filipinos in Washington, Filipinos being the Mexican of their time, or the Irish before them, or the Polish before them, or the Chinese before them. Just pick your wave of immigrants you vilify and marginalize. Also 1946, the crime, 2 young black couples are killed by a lynch mob at Moore's Ford Bridge over the Apache River. The 4 were tied up and shot hundreds of times in broad daylight by unmasked men. Murder weapons included rifles, shotguns, pistols, and machine guns. The Tuskegee Institute newspaper called it a lynching. The cover-up. Despite the intense investigation by the FBI, the killers remain free. The best people in town won't talk, says Georgia State Patrol officer, on the climate of fear and threat of retaliation that discourages law-abiding citizens to cooperate with the investigation. Again, in 2005, there was another attempt to bring the survivors of the mob to justice, but that failed as well. No justice, no peace.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلد.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. Lately, the feature presentations on This Week in Palestine have been lengthy, and we have not been able to report some of the significant new successes of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. But there has been one success that cannot go unmentioned, as reported in the following article in Mondo Weiss. British security company G4S, the world's largest, has responded to a four-year-long global BDS campaign protesting its role in Israeli violations of Palestinian human rights by announcing that it will sell its Israeli subsidiary in the coming 12 to 24 months. In describing the move, the Financial Times reported that G4S was extracting itself from reputationally damaging work. Since 2010, G4S has lost contracts worth millions of dollars in many countries following BDS pressure to end its complicity in Israeli prisons, where Palestinians are tortured and held without trial, as well as in Israeli checkpoints, settlements, and a police training center. Their lost clients include private businesses, universities, trade unions, and UN bodies. The Bill Gates Foundation in 2014 divested its $170 million stake in the company following protests at its offices in Seattle, London, and Johannesburg. In recent weeks, UNICEF in Jordan and a major restaurant chain in Colombia became the latest high-profile bodies to end their contracts with G4S following BDS campaigns. As the height of the international boycott of apartheid South Africa, BDS pressure is making some of the world's largest corporations realize that profiting from Israeli apartheid and colonialism is bad for business, said Mahmoud Nawaja, a spokesperson for the Palestinian BDS National Committee, the broadest coalition in Palestinian society that leads the BDS movement. Investment fund managers are increasingly recognizing that their fiduciary responsibility obliges them to divest from Israeli banks and companies that are implicated in Israel's serious human rights violations, such as G4S and Hewlett-Packard, because of the high risk entailed. We are starting to notice a domino effect, he added. French multinationals Veolia and Orange and CRH, Ireland's biggest company, have all exited the Israeli market in recent months, mainly as a result of BDS campaigning. United Methodist Church has put five Israeli banks on a blacklist due to their complicity in human rights violations, including the financing of illegal Israeli settlements. Palestinian lawyer Sahar Francis, director of Adamir Prison Support and Human Rights Association, commented, "We are grateful to all of the dedicated grassroots organizers around the world who are working in solidarity with Palestinians seeking freedom, justice, and equality. But G4S is infamous for breaking pledges to end its participation in Israeli crimes. Our boycott of G4S will remain among the BDS movement's top priorities until we actually see it back out of the door of Israel's regime of occupation, settler colonialism, and apartheid. We also welcome the news that G4S is also selling its business that operate youth detention centers in the U.S. and the U.K., both of which have seen G4S targeted by campaigners over its abusive practices, and both of which are part of deeply racist incarceration systems. From the U.S. to Palestine, from South Africa to the U.K., G4S is deeply involved in racist mass incarceration business. We remain determined to work closely with partners to hold G4S to account for its participation in human rights abuses." G4S also has a long and documented track record of participation in human rights and workers' rights abuses elsewhere in the world, especially in prisons and migrant detention centers it has run in the U.S., the U.K., and South Africa. Now would you add it? Failing to stop the impressive growth of BDS in pursuit of freedom and justice, Israel is desperately trying to smear and delegitimize our nonviolent movement, including with anti-democratic laws in Europe and the U.S. aimed at silencing dissent and suppressing our freedom of speech. We believe strongly that our ethical approach and just cause will prevail, as this latest G4S announcement shows. In September 2015, French corporate giant Veolia sold off all its businesses in Israel. This was a direct result of a seven-year campaign against its role in infrastructure projects for illegal settlements in Israel that cost more than $20 billion in lost tenders and contracts. A leading French-based Israeli business recently told the Israeli media that the growing strength of the BDS movement means that most major European companies now avoid investing in Israel. Foreign direct investment in Israel dropped by 46% in 2014 as compared to 2013, according to a UN report, partially due to the impressive growth of the BDS impact, as stated by one of the report's authors. That was an article from the news service Mondelēz. So now we know why Israel is investing so much time, energy, and money fighting the BDS movement, including a state-by-state stealth campaign to develop legislation opposing BDS here in the United States. It is beginning to cost them money, big time, and they are lashing back. This morning, our feature presentation is by Nadia Ben-Youssef, the U.S. representative of the human rights organization and legal center, Adala. Adala means justice in Arabic and is based in Haifa. She speaks about the attempts of Adala to save a Bedouin village in the Negev of Israel, a village named al-Haran, which has been in existence since the early 1950s. Now Israel has decided to level al-Haran to build a much larger, exclusively Jewish town that will be named just Haran. The Negev is huge and mostly unpopulated, yet Israel continues its purging of Bedouin villages by choosing this particular site for a new Jewish town rather than building on much available vacant space. Nadia Ben Youssef's presentation refers occasionally to PowerPoint images, which obviously cannot be seen by our radio audience, but most of these images simply illustrate how the new Jewish town will replace the village of al-Haran and are not central to her compelling narrative. Nadia gave this presentation at Tufts University. She's introduced by Tufts anthropology professor Amal Bishara.
Okay, I want to thank all of you for being here today, and I also want to especially thank Nadia Ben Youssef for being here today. She's just back from Palestine, and you, like, not 48 hours, right?
Right.
And I think that really we've all been, and those of us who've been following the story of al-Haran have been in shock since the new court case came out that after 13 years of legal struggle, this community of 1,000 people is really facing immediate displacement and demolition of their community. And you're going to hear a lot more about that, obviously, from Nadia Ben Youssef. So I'm just going to give you a little introduction to her. Since 2010, Nadia has been working with Adala, which is one of the most preeminent human rights organizations in Israel, Palestinian human rights organizations as well. And one of the big cases that they have taken on is that of the Bedouin community in the Naqab, and it's been a specialty of yours, as I understand. Before working at Adala, she's worked on human rights violations in India. She's served as a speechwriter and legal assistant to Ms. Sherry Blair, and she's also worked as a civil litigator for indigent clients in the area here, in the Boston community. She also speaks fluent French and Spanish and Arabic. She, for those of you who are thinking about pursuing careers in human rights law, I think this is a great opportunity for you to talk to somebody who's done it so beautifully and so successfully. She got her law degree from Boston College with a certificate in human rights and international justice. And now in the United States, she's been doing a lot of really fascinating and important solidarity work with a lot of different communities, Arab American communities, African American communities, Jewish communities, and others. She publishes in The Nation, Huffington Post, among other places. And I've just been delighted that we kind of fortuitously have you as part of the Boston community. Adela's work is moving at a vital, vital importance, and so having you here in the community to bring that here and also augment it with everything else you're doing that's not just, you know, sort of revolving around Adela is a tremendous gift. Some of you probably heard about Naqab and al-Haran last year when Suhad Bishara of Adela presented. And I just find that, frankly, we should, as a community with resources and specialty and concern with this area, it's a good commitment for us to say we're going to keep following this case. We're going to know what's going on and we're going to do what we can because this is a really, really urgent case. So thank you for presenting this update and this talk on al-Haran versus head-on.
Thank you so much. So thank you so much. Thank you so much for being here and spending your free block with us and being concerned about this case, learning about what's going on, and seeing how we can work together. And in fact, it's a really good opportunity for me to dialogue a bit with you because we've kind of reached the end of the road in many ways. In terms of the legal work that we can do to save this village. So a lot of that is now turning, and we've had an advocacy strategy to coincide, which is the way that Adala does its work. But this is a hard story to tell. For some reason, it's a really hard story to tell. It seems very clear what's going on. It seems pretty, and I think the issue is that it's so clear that it actually seems absurd. That the case actually seems absurd. So what I'm going to do is tell you a bit about the Naqab generally, just to give a bit of background, and then we're going to go right into this case. And I'll give you legal updates, what the Supreme Court of Israel has said, and also what the community is gearing up to do, and how then maybe to think about what mobilizing here could look like. I'm interested. I have a notebook next to me. I want to hear your ideas. I want to think with you about what resonates with you as Americans, as students, as people who care about these issues, who care about social justice, so that we can maybe tailor our messaging in such a way that will be more effective. It's a devastating case. We were shocked in fact, and it's hard to be shocked in Palestine. But we were shocked by the decision. So I'll run through this a little bit, and then hopefully, if there's something to interrupt me a bit, please feel free. And thank you again for having me. So, in fact, though, should I say, you said something about Adela, so this is good. We're going to talk about the Maqam. So this little map, put a little red square around it. The Naqab is about 60% of the land of Israel. So it's in the south, 60% of the land, 10% of Israelis live here. So it's sparsely populated. Not very many people live in the Naqab, but about 32% are Palestinian Bedouin. So just a broad overview of the demographics in Israel so that we can be clear. One in five Israelis is a Palestinian. One in five Israelis is a Palestinian. 20% of the population of Israel. Palestinians who remained in their homeland after the Nakba, after the catastrophe, after the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948, and became a homeland minority, essentially. So they became citizens, all Palestinians who remained inside Israel after the state was established, became citizens in 1952. Became full Israeli citizens in 1952, but lived under a military regime until 1966. And this is an interesting date if people are following dates and can think about connections. 1966, of course, you have the occupation begins in 1967. So just where we're talking about. So in the Naqab, 32% of the population is Palestinian Bedouin. And they live now about number around 200,000 people. 200,000 people. 100,000 Palestinian Bedouin citizens of Israel live in what are called unrecognized villages. There are 35 unrecognized villages in the Naqab. And what that means, what does that mean? Also, I think this is like where this starts becoming crazy and difficult to comprehend. Unrecognized villages. Unrecognized by whom? Here's a map. Here are villages. But this is not a map of the state. This is a map by the Regional Council of the Unrecognized Villages, an organization in the Naqab, because these villages don't exist on any maps. On any maps, if you look at a map of the state of Israel, you're not going to see any of these 35 unrecognized villages. And these villages either predated the establishment of the state, so they were already here in this area in the Naqab, before the state was established in 1948, or, and this is the case of Hiran, or were created by military order when the military government of Israel concentrated the Bedouin community into a smaller area in the Naqab. They concentrated them and moved them away from their ancestral land. So when we're going to be talking about Hiran here, their ancestral land is near Gaza, and they were moved here in 1956 by military order. None of that is disputed, and it becomes a really important issue in the case. Because what the state says, despite the fact that most of these villages predated the establishment of the state says, and this is really interesting, and if you're interested in law and you're interested in understanding law not as a powerful tool, but as a tool of the powerful, you might find this very compelling, because legally, all of the Palestinian Bedouins are trespassers on state land. After the state was established, all of the land of the Naqab became state land. So the people who were there, even if they were there before the law suddenly declared this a state land, became trespassers on state land. So their villages became illegal under Israeli law, and so they are not on any maps. They're disconnected from any basic services. No water, no electricity, no sewage, no roads, no schools, no health clinics. And these are citizens of Israel. So maybe you're thinking, what does citizenship mean? And you would be right to think that. What is the law? You would be right to think that. This is so absurd, which is why it's hard to tell this story. This is Hiran. Hiran. And I'm going to talk about Hiran and Atiyah. So the name that we said for the talk is Hiran versus Hiran. And we use that because it's really quite striking. But these are twin villages. Atiro Mehran, if you go back to this map, they're really close to each other, Atiro Mehran, and they're from the same family, the Abulkian family, who came from the Gaza Strip, and they settled right next to each other, but in two areas, across about 7,000 dunams, four dunams to an acre, you know, just a bit, I don't know, across this area. So Atiro Mehran. But this is the village of Hiran. Now we have about 1,000 people who live in Atiro Mehran, into these two twin villages. In 2003, the Israeli government issued home demolition orders on all of the villages, in all of the houses of the village, an eviction lawsuit against the residents of Atiro Mehran, and declared the houses illegal, and started preparing a plan for the village, the new town, the new settlement of Hiran. The name of the Palestinian Bedouin village is Hiran. The name of this new Jewish town, established by the state, is called Hiran. This is from the master plan of Hiran, which is going to be was originally declared in 2003 when this was first proposed, or 2007 when it was first proposed, as an exclusively Jewish town. Exclusively Jewish town. And in fact, that can happen in the state of Israel. There can be exclusively X towns. 43% of all towns in Israel are run by, and these are small towns, so the issue is that this became a bit of a bigger town, so they can't really do exactly what they want. It's going to be about 2,000 people. But small communities in Israel can be governed by what are called admissions committees. Admissions committees are groups of five citizens. One has to be a member of the Jewish Agency, the other has to be a member of the World Zionist Organization, and these committees can decide who can enter or not into that town on the basis of the criteria, which was green-lighted by the Supreme Court of Israel. The criteria is on the basis of social suitability, whether or not someone is socially suitable to live in that town. So when this was first announced in 2007, we thought it would be governed by admissions committees that could say, this is an exclusively Jewish town. Now, because it's a larger village, and because there's been some negative press around this idea, the state is no longer saying this is exclusively Jewish, but the Supreme Court has acknowledged that it's going to be majority Jewish, and the residents, who we'll meet very soon, are actually ideological settlers originally from the West Bank, who are coming into Hiran. So this is the map of Hiran, and you'll notice here is Hiran in the purple, and it's basically right on top, right where there's going to be a residential area. So Hiran is mapped out exactly on Hiran.
Can I ask a question?
Please.
About the map there. The purple, you all didn't add that in. It's actually in their official map?
Yeah. So standing houses to be demolished. It's in their map.
It's in their map.
And they're like, I don't know. There's some homes here. And can I? Here's a pause. I'm telling you, it's so absurd. 2012, I was at the Southern District Planning Committee in Beersheba, in the south of Israel. And we're there discussing Hiran. And the lead planner, the lead urban planner for this village of Hiran, was there. He's from Tel Aviv. And he was there, and he was with his team. And we were... So you're in the interior ministry, so you can't use like cameras or recorders or anything. This dude was taking pictures of our dear colleague Suhad Bishara, who's the lead lawyer on the case, taking pictures of her and like watching her speak. And she was telling the story of Hiran. And so I was like so upset that this was happening. And after this hearing, and I'm telling you this just because it makes this look, anyway. The guy comes up to Suhad, and he's like, I had no idea. I had no idea about this case. I've never been. I've never been to this area. And when I looked on a map, there is no such thing as Hiran. And when I looked at our plan, It was just these standing structures to be demolished. So he was shocked, which I just find so tragic, so tragic. But the rest of the team had been there, they knew about it, and they went forward anyway. Does anyone read Hebrew in this class? Here's where it gets even crazier. It says Hiran. It says Hiran. What's happening here is in 2014, we're preparing for the Supreme Court decision. And we're in the village. And there had been rumors for about 2 years that the settlers who were going to live in al-Hiran were already there, living in a nearby forest, waiting for the demolition of the village. And we asked the residents of al-Hiran, like, have you seen them? And they said, no, like, I mean, we did like a 2 kilometer radius, like, I don't know, there's no settlers. We were taking affidavits from the community for the Supreme Court hearing. Oh, Lord. And Ali Aboulghian comes rushing in to Suhad, and he's like, I found them. We found them. And she was like, what? And Suhad got in the Jeep. It was night, and she got in the Jeep, and she came back, and she was shaking. She was like, you would not believe what I saw. They're there. They're waiting. And we were like, what? Crazy. So the next day, I went as, like, an undercover journalist. I was terrible. But this is what we saw. This is what's in the middle of the forest, in Yatir Forest. So on, but it's on the 48, on the Israeli side of the Green Line. All this, again, is happening inside Israel. You go, and there's a big military gate, and you have a proper community. A proper community, there's electricity, there's water, there's recycling services, and there's this amazing, amazing bus stop. Amazing bus stop that in Hebrew says it's the regional council of Mount Hebron. What? Hebron, in the West Bank. The regional council of Mount Hebron. Hebron is a very important and vicious settlement of Jewish Israelis who live there. So it's very interesting what's happening. Just for Americans, I think this is important. This mobile home was made possible through the generosity of JNF USA and its commitment to Blueprint Negev. JNF, the Jewish National Fund, is one of the premier Jewish institutions in the world, and it's usually known for afforestation plans. I'm not sure why I put this here, but essentially it's to remind us again of the... No, I don't know. Maybe it's to show you where we are. This is Yatir al-Hiran. This is Lev Yatir. This is where the settlement is located. I want to show you a video, if I can. And then we'll move quickly, I hope. Is this okay? Interesting? So we made this video when we went to see... So Adana has represented Yatir al-Hiran, the two villages, through the entire... legal system in Israel. And in May of 2015, the Supreme Court said, go ahead, to the state, it's fine. Any attempts that we had made to cancel the eviction orders, to cancel the home demolition orders were denied. And amazingly, the court says this is not the address for creating chaos. So don't bring us this case. What's interesting here is, Lord, what's not interesting here? The major way that we can use the legal system in Israel, particularly with regard to the Bedouin, the facts that we'll use in order to challenge demolition orders or eviction lawsuits. We have to deal with two primary arguments of the state, which I mentioned at the beginning, that they're trespassers. The Bedouin are trespassers, so they're lawbreakers according to the laws of Israel. So we're not going to do anything exceptional to help you out. You're a trespasser. The second is that this land where you are, Bedouin, and this is kind of it's a very interesting argument, is not suitable for residential use. So even if we wanted you to stay there, and maybe we do, it's not good for you. It's not good for you, Bedouin, so you need to leave. This case, Adala was able to prove through archives, military documents, exactly what I said, so that the military moved these people here in 1956 and gave them the 7,000 dunams of land. So they weren't trespassers, and the court had to accept it. And the court did accept it. And as to the second argument, that this is not suitable for residential use, the plan of Hiran disproves that pretty easily. In fact, it is a beautifully suitable place for residential use if you're the right kind of resident. If you're the right kind of resident. So in the decision, basically the court said, and this was a 2-to-1 decision, so there's 15 justices on the Supreme Court. Oftentimes in cases like this, you would think you would have an expanded panel to address this pretty clearly discriminatory policy of demolishing one village because the residents are Palestinian or Bedouin and replacing it with the Jewish community. They didn't get to that issue. Even the dissenting judge, didn't get to that issue. She said, you know, she thought maybe that the Bedouin might have some rights, but nonetheless, it's not about discrimination. They said, listen, okay, you're not trespassers. We did give you the land, but it's public land, so we can take it back. We can take it back. So they said, it's ours. We can do with it what we would. And alternatives exist. So what does that mean? The plan of the state for the Bedouin is to move them into a nearby town. It's a township called Hura. So in the Naqab, I remember there was 200,000 people, 100,000 live in unrecognized villages. The other 100,000 live in either what are called recently recognized villages, these are villages that since 2003 have been recognized by the state, or government-planned towns. There are 7 government-planned towns, and they are the poorest in Israel, highest rates of crime, of poverty, no industry. It reminds me in many ways of a kind of a reservation policy. These are towns where you drive through them and you're like, what is this? Like, this doesn't look like any other town that I know. And so these towns, there are 7 of them. Hura is one of them. The plan is to move them to Hura. So they said, listen, there's an alternative. You can go. And that was the decision of the Supreme Court. We requested a second hearing in July. One, for the expanded panel that I mentioned, to have more people look at this case. And 2, asking, because it's an extraordinary decision, to demolish an entire village, displace 1,000 people in order to create the town of Hiran. And I haven't spoken about it much, but in Atir, the plan is to level the village of Atir, which is nearby, and to expand the Yatir forest. So it'll be expanded forest and grazing land for Hiran. This line, I think, in January is difficult to read. And it's more difficult because of the next slide I'm going to show you. In the court said, this case is not one that can be considered to be exceptionally exceptional, the rarest of rare, to warrant another hearing. And they denied our hearing, our request. We haven't released this yet. We're releasing it today. And I'll tell you why and what's happening on the ground. But as we were kind of racking our brains after this decision, looking at Supreme Court precedents, we went back like 2 months to August. So the case was in May. The original decision was in May. In August, 3 months later, the Supreme Court issued this crazy decision. So we've made this infographic in the last week called The Zeltzers versus Atiro Manera. So the story of the Zeltzers is a family of 5 that live near Jerusalem. And there's a plan to they have state permission to live here. They were given permission. And the plan around Jerusalem is to expand a forest, so another afforestation plan. And it would be over their home. Over their home. So they lived there since 1974. They have permission to live there, and now there's a new plan. This is a family of 5. And they went to the Supreme Court, similar process, you know, challenging the plan. Then they went to the Supreme Court to say, this is an exception to, you know, the how dare you state. And this is the line that was used by the Israeli Supreme Court in August of 2015. This case before us is a very special and unique case. And the court decided the family should stay and the state should reconsider its plans. The family should stay and the state should reconsider its plans. The implications of this decision are huge, are huge. There are, again, 35 unrecognized villages. Basically, what the Supreme Court has said is, I mean, this is our strongest case in the Naqab. Adala does what's called impact litigation. So we look for the strongest case that's going to have a wide impact on a lot of people, or we're taking cases that challenge large policies. So we are really strategic about the cases that we choose, and we're really cautious about land cases in Israel, because land and citizenship are the foundational issues of the state, and the state really can't let go of its control over those two kind of realms of the polity. So we took this case specifically. They're not trespassers. They were moved here by the state. This is a clearly discriminatory plan. Jewish citizen versus Palestinian citizen. Jewish privilege. Very, very clearly laid out. So we were shocked to lose this case, really. And often, like, again, we're not usually that shocked because it's a disaster. And we're using essentially a colonial legal regime. And how do you use the law of the oppressor to protect the rights of the oppressed? It's very difficult, and we know that. But we took this case because we thought we could win. We didn't win. And so there are 35 unrecognized villages throughout the Naqab, 70,000 people who live there. There's a green light precedent to demolish all of those villages, which is just insane. It's insane, but it's not out of the ordinary, and it's not even out of Israel's intentions. In 2011, they passed this Proverb plan. I don't know if anyone heard of this Proverb plan. It was basically a large government plan to do exactly that, to demolish all of the 35 unrecognized villages and concentrate the Bedouin into those townships, the seven townships, or the recently recognized towns. And we fought that mostly like through community mobilization, organizing, challenging the plan, and it was shelved in December of 2013. It was shelved. So the Supreme Court steps in and says, I'll give you a way to do that. I don't know if this is... I mean, basically, it's pretty clear, but this case, we also raised this in the January case because in the request for an exceptional hearing. If anyone is familiar with the disengagement plan of 2005, taking Israeli settlers out of the Gaza Strip, those settlers were there, again, illegally. Settlements are illegal under international law. They were there illegally. They were disengaged, this big disengagement from Gaza. And they went to the Supreme Court to say, oh, this is a violation of our constitutional rights to property and dignity. And the Supreme Court said, you know, right, you're right. Yes, this is a violation of dignity to lose your land in this way. And you should be compensated justly. So we brought that to the court. No constitutional rights were violated. If you're a Palestinian, your constitutional rights are conditional. Your constitutional rights are conditional, so are they meaningful at all? Again, you know, the alternatives, the compensation, the alternatives are for the people of Umm al-Hiran to move into Hura. Recently, the mayor of Hura, this government township, said, we can't take you in. We can't take, even if we wanted to take you in, and we don't want to because we want the Bedouin to be able to stay with dignity on their land. But even if we wanted to, we can't take you in. So the alternatives, which is a case that we brought in successfully, actually, one of the most only successful cases in the Naqab, in 2011, a village called Al-Sira. And Al-Sira was meant to be demolished. We went to the court, got to the district court, and they said there's no suitable alternative, so you can't just demolish this village of 350 people. So we've been able to challenge that alternative discourse, but again, not here. Tomorrow, on the ground, there's a mass demolition. No.
Lord.
Freud, disaster demonstration. There's a mass demonstration planned on the ground. It's called Not Leaving. And basically that's all that's left. And we are now in the process of kind of pushing for international action and trying to see if we can somehow pressure the state from international voices. So we'll be doing a lot, and we have been, which is what makes this pretty exhausting, at the UN, at the EU, in the United States. But we need to do a bit more, and we can do a bit more. And ultimately, you have to believe, and I do believe, that this is where it matters. The courts are one tool. The law is one tool, absolutely. But it's not the only tool. And the people of Umm al-Hiran also believe that the law is not the only tool, which is why they're continuing to mobilize. These are some of the calls that we're putting forward to the international community. And I'm interested now. I mean, I think I'll stop to hear your reactions. Again, I'm taking notes because I think we're in a bit of a disaster situation. And not to be so dramatic, Palestine is not generally a very disaster-free zone. But it is really, really important, and it's important to find a way to distill this story within your communities, within your schools, within your places of worship, distill this community to its essence, and to really consider the fact that we're going to allow this to happen, that this happens on our watch, that we are supportive or we are accepting of a state that says if you're a certain kind of person, you have rights. If you're not a certain kind of person, you don't. And do we accept that? Do we accept that? And I know we don't. And I know that you don't. I know you're here for a specific reason. But this is a test case, not on Israel, not for Palestinians, but for all of us. It's a test case. So thank you so much for listening, and I'm interested in your reactions. Thank you.
That was a presentation by Nadia Ben Youssef of the human rights organization Adala, speaking about the systematic suppression of the Bedouin people in the Israeli Negev. And finally, before we wrap it up this week, I want to play a quick interview of an amazing Palestinian journalist, author, and playwright, Rula Jubril, conducted by Max Blumenthal. The interview took place before the conference at the National Press Club organized by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, parts of which we hope to feature on This Week in Palestine in the future. Rula Jubril speaks about the AIPAC conference, the Arab Spring, and the bias of the U.S. media. It is only 3 minutes long, but it is a gem.
You know, Monday you have this big event with AIPAC is basically dismantling the principle of democracy because they're waging, you know, a war on diversity. But basically what they are saying, we can buy whatever we want. Your policies belong to us.
Where are we now? Because a few years ago we were so hopeful about the Arab Spring maybe leading to Jerusalem.
My hope is not from the Arab nation somehow. The main actor in aborting the Arab Spring was Saudi Arabia, who financed every coup in the region because they were so concerned that the arrival of democratic system will reach Jeddah and Riyadh and people will start demanding more inclusive and negotiated system. Look, it took the American Constitution to be ratified 7 years until the Battle of Yorktown. I don't know how long it will take the Arab nations to become more inclusive, but I think now there's something that happened with the Iran deal that will force the region, and they produce no stability, Saudi Arabia. It's only a liability. It's time to break that bond.
Now, you've seen it from the inside. We met when you were driven off of MSNBC for pointing out that U.S. media is biased towards Israel. It seems obvious. It's like saying water's wet and the sky is blue, and Judas told the Romans where Jesus slept. A CNN executive admitted that he helped write Netanyahu's speech to Congress.
Exactly. And then when I'm invited in CNN or in any other network, they always call me very worried. So what are you going to talk about? What are you... And they are so worried to tell the audience the truth about what's going on, because they know that this will lead to shift in public opinion. But because of people like yourself, of because of Alternate, it's because of Salon, it's because of Intercept, it's because of MondoWise, it's because of these amazing...
Electronic Intifada.
Electronic Intifada and Ali Abu Na'ma, who actually started all of this movement and part of this movement. And without these voices, incredible voices, I mean, I would have been shunned aside and disappeared I would have became a ghost probably. But today they cannot ignore these voices. These people, obviously, I shamed them in public. They couldn't take it. They're busy with petty small things. And now they're all shocked that we have Donald Trump. But they paved the way for Donald Trump and that Islamophobia, racism, misogyny, that culture has been there and they've been bred and cultivated by major analysts in this country. So it doesn't define me what happened in that episode, but it defines its shameful, stain on MSNBC forever.
That was Palestinian journalist and author Rula Jubriel. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday when our featured presentation will be by anthropologist and author Jessica Winiger, who will discuss her controversial book, Anthropology's Politics, Disciplining the Middle East. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. We're on Bristol Community FM every Tuesday at noon. This week, she was working as a CIA spy in the run-up to the Iraq War. Then, when she started to make a fuss about the illegal invasion, she was thrown into jail. Susan Lindau. Also, JFK, Grassy Knoll, assassin, James Fires. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio, one word, .co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street. You can call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. So we start with former CIA spy in the run-up to the Iraq War and author of the book Extreme Prejudice, Susan Lindau.
I'm Susan Lindauer. I'm the author of Extreme Prejudice, the terrifying story of the Patriot Act and the cover-ups of 9/11 and Iraq. I was very pleased to see the new Chilcot report, which I consider to be an outstanding representation of the actual circumstances of Iraqi pre-war intelligence. I was the chief CIA asset covering the Iraqi embassy at the United Nations in New York from 1995 to 2003. And I was actually having sit-down meetings with ambassadors and senior diplomats at the Iraqi embassy about every 3 weeks. And I was a covert back channel on terrorism intelligence, mostly.
Susan, how does someone get into a job like that?
Oh, that's a long story. The most important thing is that I was involved directly with the Iraqi ambassador in the negotiations to resume the weapons inspections. And there was a substantial peace option on the table that was offered from the very beginning of the Bush presidency in January of 2001, which stayed active right up until the invasion. And I want everyone to know that I made a point of sharing that intelligence with members of the Labour Party in Britain. I was very aggressive in communicating with the British intelligence services, with the British leadership in Parliament, specifically the Labour Party. I wanted the Labour Party to know what these options were. And so every single person that I could find, and now I'm in Washington, D.C., so I'm on the opposite side of the pond, and some of the people that I sent to might not have been exactly the right people. I will confess that. But I made a tremendous effort to get this information to Britain. I must tell you, I'm deeply satisfied by a statement that Mr. Chilcot has made, quote, "We do not agree that hindsight is required. The risks of internal strife in Iraq, active Iranian pursuit of its interests, regional instability, and Al-Qaeda activity in Iraq were each explicitly identified before the invasion." And I'm so pleased by that particular statement because I contributed to the British intelligence service on all of those points. I strongly believe that a good ally should provide the best access to the most. You have to realize I was on the ground. I was the primary source in direct contact with the Iraqi government. So you needed your MI6 and the British government needed to hear what I knew.
So were you actually over in Iraq or is this just at the UN?
I was in both places. I actually was prosecuted. My book, Extreme Prejudice, tells the story of the prosecution I suffered on the Patriot Act because I did go over to Iraq before the United Nations delegation arrived in March of 2002. And very likely the Downing Street memos about Saddam Hussein and whether or not he contributed to terrorism, that was related to me.
So let's just
very
get a picture.
Let's
get a picture of how you see the war starting, because it's a momentous thing, and I think history will look back on the Iraq War as a particularly pernicious disaster. You know, and oh, also God. Something which was set up deliberately. And remember, this country, Iraq, is the cradle of civilization for the entire humanity from, you know, thousands of years ago. And so it's quite an important, significant country to be completely overthrown in this way, which went round the United Nations. Many people say a completely illegal war, and that the people who perpetrated it, including those maybe that told the lies in the media, should stand trial for those lies and for perpetrating an illegal war. But from your perspective, how did it come about that the weapons of mass destruction lie and all the rest of the lies actually led to war in a way which was so totally unjust? And as we've more recently seen just this week, 250 innocent people killed in Baghdad in a bomb blast, that we've turned this country into a total disaster.
Well, I will tell you that before Bush came to power, before the election, it's very important to remember that he had campaigned on the lie. He was a Trojan president. He campaigned on the lie, the dishonesty, that he was not an interventionist president, that he would never go into war, create a second war in Iraq to finish what Daddy Bush had started. And all of the CIA people believed him. Now, before he even was elected, before the election, there had been a momentous break in the international community's tolerance of sanctions. A German pilot started it off, flying humanitarian supplies into Baghdad International Airport. And pretty much all of the Arab countries had unified, and they were each flying humanitarian supplies into Baghdad Airport, running the blockade. So the CIA looked at this on the ground, and they said, okay, it's over. We cannot sustain this. This is a humanitarian crisis. Sanctions are genocide. We know that 2.2 million human beings died because of the sanctions. And anybody who tells you another figure is ignorant. It is 2.2 million who died from the United Nations sanctions on Iraq, including 1 million children under the age of 5. The United Nations refused to count 6-year-olds or 7-year-olds. Okay, so right up to the inauguration of Bush, the CIA had already done an assessment, and they recognized that sanctions were over, and the human race could no longer tolerate the obscene suffering of the Iraqi people. And so now the United States, and I was anti-sanctions from day one. I was the CIA asset and defense intelligence asset covering the Iraqi embassy in New York, meeting with the diplomats, meeting with the ambassadors. I abhorred the sanctions. I thought it was reprehensible and a crime against humanity. So I was very eager to do this. Nobody had to twist my arm. I was excited to participate. I wanted to lead this. And the Iraqis knew me. They knew that they were going to get a fair deal with me. And so that's how we proceeded.
But Susan, they didn't get a fair deal, did they, ultimately?
Oh, no. But I want you to know how it started. In November, while the votes were being counted in Florida, and nobody knew who was going to be the president, whether it would be Al Gore or George Bush, the CIA had already granted me permission at the very highest levels to start talks on resuming the weapons inspections. And the deal was, we already knew in November of 2000, before Bush comes into power, we recognized that there were no WMDs, that Iraq's weapons capacity was completely exhausted. The sanctions had cut off any new access to supplies that would have been useful in creating or developing weapons, any type of weapons of mass destruction. We already knew this. And the CIA at the highest levels had already agreed. What they wanted to do was to give the new president, whether it was a Democrat or a Republican, a victory so that they could say, first foreign policy victory of the administration, hey, we got those Iraqis to agree to weapons inspections. And at the same time, we were crafting an out for the United States so that we would have the capability to say, we're going to have the weapons inspections, we're going to give Iraq a clean bill of health, and then Iraq has already agreed before you even know about this, before Bush is even in power, Iraq has already agreed to give the United States preferential contracts in the following areas: healthcare, pharmaceuticals, hospital supplies. The United States would be guaranteed to suffer no consequences for its dire support for sanctions all those years. The United States would have preferential contracts in new oil development. All oil pumping stations and pipelines would be fitted with U.S. oil equipment. The United States would be the primary oil supplier in rebuilding Iraq's biggest sectors. And that may sound abhorrent to you because of all the evil things the United States had done. But at the time, and this is no longer the case, but back in the day, in the year November 2000, the United States was still the undisputed superpower. And if you wanted to get out of sanctions, Baghdad had to give up, had to take care of the United States. My job was to make sure that we got everything for America that we could. And I will tell you straight up, Iraq agreed immediately. There was no fighting. There was no dispute. Iraq wanted out of the sanctions. They wanted to be friends with the United States and with Britain.
And it sounds to me as if that possibly was a mistake, that they should have bargained much harder, because by giving in a way, it showed their weakness. And back when it came to 2002, we've just had here in Britain the first Sea Lord, I think his name's Lord West, saying that he was told in the Royal Navy in 2002 that they had to get ready to invade Iraq. So something was going on behind the scenes, Susan, wasn't it? Cooking up a war.
Oh, absolutely,
here.
Absolutely. But I'm telling you, the reality was that from the beginning of the Bush administration, Bush was sworn into office January of 2001. And even before he was sworn in, everyone on the CIA side, it was accepted fact.
Well,
truth that Iraq had no WMDs. And right at that point, the United States was trying to negotiate the very best deal that we could get from the Iraqis. And I'm telling you, Iraq put up no fight at all. In fact, in February of 2001, 9 months before 9/11, Iraq agreed to allow the FBI to send a terrorism task force into Iraq to conduct terrorism investigations, interview witnesses, and make arrests if they desired. And Iraq agreed to comply. So we had an agreement on weapons inspections. We had an agreement on terrorism to let the FBI set up a task force inside Iraq. We had preferential contracts for American corporations. And I would like to tell you, because you're all in Britain and you all think, and I have to say this to you, at no time did anyone in the CIA say, gee, would the British like to share some of these contracts with us? The United States never gave you, I apologize for this, but it is fact, the United States never gave Britain a second thought. What would be good for your economy? What would help you? Would it create jobs in the British sector? Never gave you a second thought.
Now,
never considered advantages for you at all.
With the Chilcot report, fingers have been pointed over here at Jack Straw, the Foreign Secretary at the time, and Tony Blair, obviously. But I think you've probably got more insight into what was going on behind the scenes, because there were characters like Donald Rumsfeld and Richard Perle who were really pushing for this. So if you could point the finger and say, well, I really think that you should go to The Hague, you should answer war crimes trials, who would you point your finger at, Susan?
In Britain, I would definitely point my finger at Tony Blair and Straw. Shameful for performances. I was so grievously offended and furious that Tony Blair dared to blame the intelligence community on this. Mr. Chilcot is correct. There was a lot of good intelligence coming out of MI6. good intelligence warning them exactly what was going to happen. The consequences were well anticipated, but Mr. Kelly, for example, is a good example of somebody who paid the ultimate price, who was suicided to keep him quiet, to protect Tony Blair. I'd blame Mr. Tony Blair for Mr. Kelly's death, frankly. And it was just, it was a disgraceful performance. These leaders who demanded the war, who forced our country into the most devastating conflict, which is continuing to burn and is going to continue to explode for the next 100 years. This is the turning point of history, in my opinion. The Iraq War is the turning point of history. And Tony Blair forced our country into war, our world into war, and then lacked the courage and integrity to take responsibility for his own decisions. And I know for a fact that some factions of British intelligence tried to warn them. And in an intelligence game, it's always about factions. So some factions are in power, some are on the outs. But the British government, as you can see watching the – if you watch just the Labour Party and the Tories fight it out on the floor in Parliament, you have a healthy democracy, a healthy a community of voices that are chomping and loud and they're noisy, and democracy is so exciting and so difficult because of those different voices. But I promise you, everyone was screaming for them to stop. There were a lot of voices, very smart people, saying exactly what Mr. Chilcott has said. They were treated abominably by Tony Blair. So if you want the responsibility of office, you'd better be ready to shoulder the responsibility of the job.
But Susan,
you turn around
hang on.
And blame somebody else for your mistake.
Susan, see, the thing is, you're a spy yourself, and of course you are also part of that CIA community. You wouldn't want to blame your own people, but surely that, you know, some of the intelligence services were providing duff information, possibly deliberately, because the fact of the matter is that there are some big corporations. Big corporations that made a hell of a lot of money out of the Iraq War.
Oh, definitely. Halliburton, the oil companies. I think that a lot of the people who originally – a lot of the corporations that originally supported the war expected to make more money than they did. So they imagined that if Iraq was peaceful, they would have contracts for rebuilding the country. And what I'm saying to you is that it was never necessary to go to war to get those contracts, because the United States was going to take all of them for itself. We had no intention of giving Britain anything.
Why did they go to war if they could have had the contracts without them?
Because the war is a racket. Halliburton would not have made money. KBR, Blackwater, the mercenary, you know, the arms dealers, the weapons suppliers, that's a big business. Big business, and none of those people were going to have any profits. But I set out to guarantee, and I can promise you we succeeded in spades, to guarantee that there would be a peace dividend that would generate huge profits for shareholders. It would create jobs. It would create billions of dollars in positive revenue that, you know, without having to kill people is what I mean, positive revenue that would be, you know, building a society, rebuilding Iraq's water systems, rebuilding sanitation, rebuilding the hospitals, so that the Middle East would be stronger, healthier, more vibrant, functioning, and that there would be a good bridge between the West and the East. And we, when they started pushing for the war, I was like, are you crazy? Iran is going to be the great victor in this. That was one of the big messages that I kept pushing, was that Iran would be the victor. I'll tell you a parallel tragedy on my side of the pond. While I was locked up in prison on Carswell Air Force Base on the Patriot Act, I was accused of, quote, being, quote, not competent to stand trial. They made up a story that I was a religious maniac. I do believe in God. indisputably, I refuse to disavow my faith in God. God gives me strength. God gives me a moral compass. Those values have carried me through. You want to call it a crutch? Anybody who's an atheist, you go ahead. It is a crutch, and it's a crutch that keeps me walking. So, and it keeps my heart strong, and it keeps me positive in my vision of what I want for this world to be. So, okay, it is a crutch, fine, but it's still there. And I was accused of being incompetent because I believe in God. They actually dared to accuse me of that. And it's why I have a special contempt for Tony Blair and George Bush and Dick Cheney and Hillary Clinton and all of those politicians who now recognize the war in Iraq was a catastrophe, but who continue to blame the intelligence community. Because we all know that the intelligence community is just as fractured and there's lots of sparring and fighting and bickering between all of us. But these people really do, all of us, MI6, I'm projecting this onto MI6, but it's true. We all love our country. We all believe that we're doing something that's good for our country. And we would not want, nobody who's a professional would want to create a catastrophe and would want to be lazy and to be accused of staying silent. Great God in heaven, nobody who's in the intelligence community would ever stay silent. If you think something's wrong, we're the ones who are going to speak up. We're the ones who are going to say it first. Because that's what good intelligence is.
Yeah, but hang on, you're a spy. You've got to keep your mouth shut.
No, but in the public, yes. But in behind closed doors, I'm going to lay it on thick. I'm going to tell you exactly what I think. I'm not going to pull back any punches at all. You know, when I come out into the community, I'm going to keep my mouth shut because I do have privileged access. You know, I was in direct contact with Iraq's ambassador for years. And I'm the one who did the weapons inspections talks, which, by the way, went off beautifully. But while I was in, when they finally started running the weapons inspections, it was because we had sat down with the diplomats. We'd worked out every possible source of conflict from the past. We had worked out scenarios for exactly what had to be done differently. What behavior in previous inspections had triggered bad outcomes? How were the Iraqis going to change their behavior? And again, the United States had no intention of doing anything different itself, which is not fair.
Don't you think that they were using? Don't you think that Don't you think that the CIA were using you as a kind of Trojan horse? So you were there with good intentions, but they never had any intentions of doing anything other than invading.
Not at all. Not at all. See, that's one thing I do dispute. That again, because the intelligence community recognized that sanctions had collapsed, it was that idiot George Bush and Dick Cheney who came into power having deceived American voters. Remember at the very start of the show, of our interview, I said that during the election cycle, during the campaigns, Bush and Cheney had sworn that they would be anti-interventionist, they would never go into Iraq, they would never try to finish the war that George Bush had started. They were going to leave it alone. They're going to leave it alone. And so we all believed them. But of course, that turned out to be a lie. But the intelligence community already recognized that Iraq had no WMDs, no chemical weapons, nothing at all.
What about Colin Powell? Because I seem to remember him saying that there were very dangerous, I think, was it within how long? Several minutes or something? Dave, do you remember?
Colin Powell is a gentleman whom I despise. I put him into the same category as Tony Blair and Foreign Minister Straw. I visited him twice before his speech at the United Nations. I delivered him first the copies of the Iraqi peace option so that he would know what options were available. And the second visit, I communicated to him that the Iraqi exiles were fabricating wild lies, wildly inventing stories because they had no support inside Iraq. They desperately needed the United States to send soldiers to force their way into power because they would never have any chance of rising on their own. And so I said, we're being manipulated by the exiles because they have no natural constituency at home. They've been out of the country for 30, 40 years. Nobody knows them. All the Iraqi people know is that the exiles supported the sanctions. The sanctions are hated. The exiles are hated. They've got no future. And so they are fabricating information because they have no other way of getting back into Iraq. And I was dead on the mark accurate. Let me tell you what Colin Powell did. Colin Powell turned that information over to the FBI. When he decided to whitewash the blood and dirt off his cowardly uniform, he, on September 8th, 2005, he gave a powerful interview to a journalist named Barbara Walters, declaring that it was the mid-level people at the CIA who failed to speak up and warn him about the bad intelligence he was getting from Iraqi exiles. And except for the tiny little problem that I had done so, and he had turned my papers over to the FBI. That was on that broadcast on September 8th. On September 17th, I was declared, quote, not competent to stand trial. So I had been accused of being an Iraqi agent for opposing the Iraq war because they said it was traitorous. I was committing treason because I had spoken out against the Iraqi war. But I was demanding my right to due process. I was demanding a trial. So what they declared was that I was not competent to stand trial, not competent to assist my attorney. And on September 23rd, 2 weeks after Colin Powell's speech, I was summoned into court and ambushed, ordered to surrender to prison without a trial or a hearing. And on October 3rd, I did, in fact, surrender to prison on Carswell Air Force Base. So the whole thing in a space of less than a month, from September 8th to October 3rd, I am cleared out of the way so that Colin Powell can go out and give his grand tour of pouting and petulance, you know, declaring how bad the intelligence community was, that nobody came and told him, and it was our fault, it was never his fault, he's not responsible for this mess, don't blame me. And I was locked up in prison for a year. And when at first I was only supposed to be locked up for 4 months, but they realized that as soon as I got out, I was gonna start shouting again, and I was gonna start talking. And so they kept me for a year, and they actually argued, Tony, that I should be forcibly drugged. Forcibly drugged with Haldol, Ativan, and Prozac. Though I suffer no mental defects at all, except that I am politically inconvenient for knowing the real story of Iraqi pre-war intelligence. But it was the most terrifying experience of my life. Because I was arrested on the Patriot Act, I was subjected to secret charges, secret evidence, secret grand jury testimony. I was not allowed to see the evidence that my attorney was holding, that my first attorney was holding, until after the charges were dismissed. My first attorney refused to turn over my legal files to the second attorney until right after the charges were dismissed. And then the day after the case was dismissed, all of a sudden everything is sent to me. And I found the records from Colin Powell demanding that I had to be removed.
Amazing. Looking back now on that time in jail, how did you survive?
It was the most terrifying experience of my life. And I'm not saying that anybody who goes to prison, it's very unpleasant. Nobody wants to do that. Don't break the law. It's an awful experience. But my case was traumatizing because I was denied the right to a trial. What they wanted to do was to lock me up for 10 years in prison. They actually petitioned the court to do this. Lock me up for 10 years, declaring that that I was not competent, and therefore I should be denied the right to a hearing in case perhaps I could bring witnesses or prove evidence that my story was true. And while I would be locked up for 10 years, I would be put into a straitjacket and tied down and forcibly injected with drugs that would chemically lobotomize me so that my brain would be cooked, and I would be, until I was so wrecked and ruined and physically destroyed that I would never be a threat. The truth of what I knew would never be a threat to anyone like Tony Blair or George Bush or Dick Cheney or Colin Powell. What scum. That's why I have to tell you, I admire Mr. Chilcott's report very much. And to me, it's personally significant. And the only thing I would add to it that he may not know, they may know this or they may not. They do know that MI6 possessed this information about the real good quality information about what would happen, and that it is not hindsight. Everyone talked about it during the period of time. The one thing that I would add is that while the official channel at the CIA did not share this, our warnings, did not share the peace option, did not share the fears and the catastrophic analysis, behind the scenes, the individual assets like myself, we did make sure you got it. So we were trying to be good allies to the British by making sure that even if it didn't go through official channels, we took this to the Labour Party. And we took this to Tony Blair's own, not his, I guess you call them a shadow cabinet. I don't know that these people were on his shadow cabinet. They may have been. Some of them may have been. But I was sending information all over Britain, all over the parliament.
Now, you visited Iraq, and obviously before the war actually started. Is that right?
Yes.
Could you? Because I mean, we know now it's a really a failed state in many ways, where bombs can go off and kill hundreds of innocent people at any time, and they are doing it quite regularly. It's a country where there is no real proper security anymore. How would you contrast the Iraq that you saw to what we have now?
Saddam Hussein was a brilliant leader. Saddam Hussein, I was very impressed, had been able to rebuild the country despite the sanctions. He had motivated the peoples to reach past their tremendous suffering and to rebuild with no resources, no money, just with sweat and blood and tears. And I have to say that everybody talks about Saddam as if he was this dastardly, villainous, dangerous man. I did not see that in Saddam. I saw a survivor. I saw someone who could be ruthless, definitely ruthless, but not a coward. He rose to the challenge of defending his people, and he gave them order. This would never have happened under Saddam. Nothing that has happened in the past 15 years would have been possible when Saddam Hussein was in power. Iraq would have survived.
Did you ever meet him?
No, but I met his security chiefs. I met some of the members of the Revolutionary Council. And I understood from diplomats that before they would go to New York, when they were home while they were waiting for assignment, that he would speak to them about me, and that they were told that I was an acceptable person for them to contact, and that Saddam was very much aware of what we were doing. They always said that.
What about this idea that the war was completely cooked up by the neocons? And I know that leaks coming out of the Bilderberg conference in 2002, I can remember speaking to Jim Tucker about this, who covered that conference, that Henry Kissinger and others, in fact, there's also the one of the bosses of EADS, the big arms firm here, the biggest one in Europe, actually, at that conference, were all, it seems, talking about having an invasion before any reason had been actually delivered. So there was no evidence that an invasion was needed. So, I mean, from you being on the inside, what do you make of this whole ability of arms firms, power brokers behind the scenes to, I suppose, tear up the UN Charter in cases like this?
Well, tear up the UN Charter, but also what they did was destroy the UN as a credible, functioning force of diplomacy. Right there at that most important moment, it's like the United Nations crumbled and it never got back on its feet again. The United Nations was, after the war in Iraq, the United Nations was exposed for having committed genocide without cause, and its credibility was wrecked. Whether or not the West, whether or not London and Washington want to acknowledge this, from that point on, the United Nations has never been any sort of effective, useful tool. It is just a dead body of waste, of nothing. It contributes nothing. There's no usefulness to it at all. When London and Washington forced the world into war over the objections of the United Nations without using the proper tools of the United Nations, they wrecked the United Nations forevermore. And it will never be trusted again. It will never be – I would never go back to the United Nations for any reason. It's just not worth anything.
Now, Bush, Blair – Jack Straw, Colin Powell, Dick Cheney. Is there anyone else you'd like to add to the list to be indicted at The Hague or as possible war criminals?
The tragedy is they'll never do it. They'll never do it, but they should. I would like to see, I would love to see Tony Blair and Jack Straw indicted. I would love to see George Bush indicted. That man is the walking incarnation of the devil, as far as I'm concerned. He's one of the George Bush has got to be one of the most evil, stupid people on this planet. A spoiled little rich boy who lacked the courage and integrity to take responsibility for his own actions. But you should never think that the mainstream CIA was worrying about Britain. You should never think that they cared what happens to you. When we were negotiating the peace option to get, you know, benefits for the United States, nobody said, hey, let's get some benefits for Britain.
So what was in it for Britain then?
Nothing. We had nothing in it for you. And I hope that message gets out, because the United States didn't care whether Britain achieved any benefits from this war at all. We had no concern for you.
Now, we've got the situation now with ISIS, this so-called terrorist group organized from within. We had Al-Qaeda to start with. There's now talk of supporting Al-Qaeda against ISIS in some circles. And there seems to be a complete failed state in Iraq and Syria. How have we got to this
failed
point?
State? Yes, it is a failed state, and Syria is a disaster. Libya is a disaster. All failed states.
Who benefits?
Tell you, my greatest,
Susan, who
no
benefits?
Benefits
who benefits from this? Somebody surely must benefit from it.
Well, the short term benefit would be the arms contractors, the arms dealers. But what's happened now is that the military that has to go fight the wars are now broken. Our soldiers who would use those weapons in battle are now completely dysfunctional. They've got brain injuries, post-traumatic stress, record suicides in the United States. The U.S. military has been destroyed from within because of these wars. So even if you're buying the weapons, you don't have the soldiers who are capable of using the weapons. No one is going to be able to put boots on the ground in the Middle East again. Hillary Clinton is delusional, imagining that she can go start a war in Iran and she's going to go start a war in Lebanon. And that's the problem, is that we have this neocon redux that Hillary Clinton thinks, well, okay, I got it wrong all those other times, but maybe this time I'll get it right. Hillary Clinton is perhaps, I would consider, the most dangerous woman in the world right now, because she is capable of unleashing more hell, more violence against the planet that's going to destroy more civilizations, just like Iraq. And she's doing it for Israel. She's absolutely motivated by this blind desire to help Israel. And it's not good for anybody. The United States Treasury is bankrupt. U.S. military is broken down and incapable of the soldiers themselves. They're good people. They started off as good people, but now they're wrecked and hollowed out, like after World War One, I would say. Like when your soldiers came home after World War One and there was shell shock. That's what we're dealing with here. We cannot fight a war. We can't.
What about your book? Just tell us about that, please, Susan.
My book is Extreme Prejudice, The Terrifying Story of the Patriot Act and the Cover-Ups of 9/11 in Iraq. And it's actually very important. I hope that all those people following the Chilcot Report will buy my book from Amazon in Britain, because you'll see the real story of the peace option, the history of the efforts to stop the war from inside the intelligence community, which were very aggressive. And I'm very pleased that Mr. Chilcot is acknowledging this, and he's not saying that all of this information that we have now is hindsight. There was a lot of good people, and I'm patting myself on the back, but I'm also patting MI6 on the back. And there's some other lots of good people who were not passive and stupid. We spoke up. We were aggressive because of the nature of our business, which is that you project an appearance of silence on the outside. You know, that's professional behavior. But inside, behind closed doors, there was, you know, that we were fighting as hard as we've ever fought anything. And even though the formal channels between Britain and Washington were silent on this antipathy towards the war, behind the scenes, again, the back channels into Britain were flowing hard with warnings and saying, don't do this. The real stuff in the United States says, don't do this. This is a mistake. It's a catastrophe. And the British, I'm very pleased to see, are acknowledging that now too.
Susan Lindauer there. She was working as a CIA spy in the run-up to the Iraq War. Then, when she started to make a fuss about the illegal war, she was thrown into jail. Susan Lindauer.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
James Files was the Grassy Knoll assassin, part of the Chicago Mafia hit team that murdered and assassinated John F. Kennedy. Now we have the latest in our series of interviews with James Files.
Like I say, the Dow Tech building, that had to have been previously arranged with them because they already had made arrangements to get the people in there. So the Dow Tech could not have been a last-minute decision, as far as that goes, like me saying, okay, I think the Dow Tech building. He just used me as a sounding board.
Now, when you say had arranged to get you in the Dow Techs, I mean, that was an office building. Anybody could walk in and out. You're talking about getting into a specific
Into a specific area. Reason they needed somebody there to get them inside, anybody could walk in and out. But the sole purpose of having a connection there, somebody that could get you into a place, into an office where you could open a door and you could have a window to shoot from. If you don't have an opening, don't do you no good to get in the building. You've got to be able to get into somebody's office that's not being used, nobody around. Otherwise, the door would be locked. You'd have no way in.
You happen to know which office that was?
No, I do not know which office it was.
What did you do?
What did I do? We rolled around there. We walked around the plaza for a little bit. Then I took him back over. I dropped Mr. Nicoletti back off at the Dallas Cabana. And he got with Johnny. They therefore went back over there. I told him where the car would be pulling alongside the building there and parked. He told me that they would come out of the building, they would get in that car. Now then, I did not drop Charles Nicoletti or Johnny Roselli off at the Dow Tech building. They got into the building, they were there on their own. I told him where the car would be, it's his car, he knows his car. He knows what my job is. They'll be in the car. He'll be in the front seat. Johnny will be in the back seat. I'll get under the driver's wheel. I'll set my briefcase between the front and the back seat. We'll drive away.
Where did you drop him off?
When we pulled out from the side of the building there, I made a right and turned on to Houston. I believe that would be going north. I'm not sure now in my direction, but I made a right on Houston and went up Houston to a major intersection, about 4 or 5 blocks, maybe 6 blocks, whatever it was. Then I took a left-hand turn. I went down close to the freeway there, and there's a gas station there. I want to say Texaco, but it could have been something else. Might have even been a mobile. I'm not sure now. But they had a car there. This is where they told me to stop. This is where he told me he would be getting out at. You know, he said, go down here. We got a car waiting for us. And I drove down there. They opened the door. They got out. They started walking across the parking lot.
Now, this is before?
This is after the assassination.
After. Okay.
This is after the assassination.
Go back to before. You said you didn't let them off at the Dow-Texas.
I took Charles Nicoletti back to the Dallas Cabana to meet with Johnny Roselli. Okay?
After you walked around Dealey
Plaza. After we walked around Dealey Plaza. There's still another hour to go probably before the assassination is going to go down.
I make that statement. Okay. After we walked around for about an hour, I took Mr.
Nicoletti. After we walked around the plaza, I took Mr. Nicoletti back to the hotel, let him out of the vehicle. He went up and got with Johnny Roselli. I took the car back to secure where it's supposed to be, make arrangements, and he asked me, what if you can't get a parking space there? I told him, don't worry, I'll have a parking space. If I have to, I'll steal a car and move it out of there. I said, we'll be parked there. Just look for the car. And at this point, he told me, he said, we come out. He said, I want the car close so I can get in it right away. But he'd be carrying a rifle underneath his top coat, like his jacket, his top coat. And he would come out of there and secure that in the trunk. He'd put it in the trunk. He had to keep it in the trunk. He'd put that in the trunk, close the trunk. Johnny get in the back. Johnny Roselli would get in the back seat. He'd get in the passenger side. I'd come walking up. I'd get under the get in the driver's side. I'd enter my attaché case, briefcase, whatever you want to call it, gun case in between the front and the back seat. I'd get in, start the car, we'd drive away. I'd make a ride on Houston. I'd go down Houston, several blocks there, I forget the intersection. Make a left-hand turn, go down by the gas station just before you get by that freeway there. And that'd be the Simmons Freeway at that area. And they got out of the car. They had a car waiting there. Which car it was, I don't know. Never watched them walk across the parking lot to it. As soon as they got out, the door closed, put it in gear, and I drove away. I went back to Mesquite, Texas.
Okay, again, though, that was after all the shooting.
That was after all the shooting. After I took Charles Nicoletti back to the hotel, I went back to the plaza, secured the car, got my briefcase out with a gun in it, with a fireball in it. I went into the railroad yard. I secured that over there, put it away so nobody see it. Reversed my jacket inside out. I'd taken my hat, great door, like, and my jacket was a great poplin. We had these car jackets back then. They were like waist length, not a short jacket, but they kind of come down a little bit. It's no car jacket, like, made out of a material that they no longer use. It was called poplin. You might remember that material. The poplin material, grayish color, had a shine to it. Excuse me. That's what the jacket was like that I was wearing, a pair of gray pants with it. And I reversed the jacket that had the offset plaids in it, like, you know, kind of like checkered on the inside. When I turned it over, it looked like one of the old gray flannel shirts that we used to wear out, you know, when you was doing work in the yard or something or another. Excuse me. And I walked around the railroad yard, and I was waiting for the time to pass. Time was coming on. And when I heard the roar of the crowd, I'd been over by the fence, and I got there a little bit, a few minutes early. I'd reach down, I'd taken the scope off the weapon, and I'd look up, and I'd look over the fence, and I would looking for people. What I was looking for was not to see who I knew, but I was looking for people that would be carrying a bulge like up under their arm. I'm looking for somebody with a weapon. This way I have an idea.
Looking for security people?
I'm looking for security people. Cops, undercover, security, off-duty, whoever might be carrying a weapon. Bulge along their hip, behind their back, like I say, under the arm in a shoulder holster. I'm looking for these little bulges. Most people don't pay no attention to that. But this is what I'm looking for. But then my amazement, I recognized several people out of the past that were in Dealey Plaza. Did I go talk to them? No. But I recognized them and seen them there.
Who was that?
I remember Al Olivera. Remember seeing him there. A lot of people say Jack Ruby was never there, but he was there before the motorcade got there. I know that for a fact. And I, even though I didn't know Jack Ruby, but I was as close to him as I was you in the coffee shop, but I never spoke to him. I was never introduced to him. Never said a word to Jack Ruby. But I was that close. I'm looking at the back side of him, and I'm pretty sure that was him. Diaz was there. I believe his name was Tony. Tony Diaz is what I knew him as. Richard Kane, he was on scene. He was in the crowd. He had been there early. He was leaving. He was walking like away. Philip Alarezo, I know he was there that day. Where he went, I have no idea. But there were several people that I saw.
How about Frank Sturgis?
Frank Sturgis, he was there.
How did you know Frank Sturgis?
I knew Frank Sturgis from the Bay of Pigs and from the SAO. I also knew Orlando Bosch. He was on scene. Orlando Bosch. I don't know if you're familiar with his name or not, but he was also present. And there's a few other faces I recognized. I just don't remember the names for them because it's so long ago.
How do you figure all those people were in Dealey Plaza?
You know, I couldn't figure that one out myself, but it's like anything else. It's like everybody, they know something's going to happen. Maybe they know a building's going on fire or something. You know, you got a building burning and may collapse. Everybody runs to see the fire. They should be going the other way. About the only time I've ever seen a lot of confusion was where people were trying to get away, like if you're the racetracker in a crowded place and somebody yelled gun, everybody broke and stampeded. And we had a few people out the racetrack get hurt that way there out at Maywood Park that got hurt in a stampede like that. But basically speaking, if somebody knows something's going to happen, they have a tendency to go see it. Most people are curious. You know, you ever drive down the highway, you see a wreck? You're probably guilty of it. You slow the car down, look out the window. Everybody does it. So a lot of people come there for that reason, probably because they had heard these rumors and stuff that he was going to be assassinated in Dallas. That was no secret. Right. Even the National Security Agency knew that.
What about Eugene Braden?
Eugene Braden? He was there that day. He was the... Eugene Braden was there for a specific reason. He had the contacts inside the Dow Tech building. And he was the one that Charles Nicoletti and Johnny Roselli needed to get him into the private office somewhere or another. I have no idea where that office was. I was never in the Dow Tech building myself, so I can't even describe anything in there.
So you probably stood behind that fence there for some little time.
Only for a few. I stayed away from the fence. I stayed basically in the yard, walk over the fence, look over it, spend a minute, then walk back away again. But I was observing the area.
Were you a smoker at the time?
Oh, yes, I did smoke.
Were you smoking cigarettes that morning?
I had smoked that day. Careless. I probably stepped on several cigarette butts and left them there. Most of them Pall Mall.
Was it muddy back there?
It was very muddy. Let me put it this way. I, a couple of times, even took my shoes, put them up on the little concrete ledge and scraped the mud off the bottom of them.
What clothes
I hate getting mud on.
Frank Sturgis wearing?
I don't remember exactly the clothes. I remember he had on like a bomber jacket. Remember the World War II bomber jackets the pilots used to wear? He was wearing one like that. Like that, like the one you got right there. His had the brass buttons on it. Remember that. You can see that flashing, you know.
Which location of Dealey Plaza was he standing?
I was where you got the concrete steps to go down by the pergola there, and between the pergola and the stockade fence, you got a set of concrete steps to go down. I was to the right of those.
Draw me a map.
I got to put my glasses on for that.
Have you got them with you?
Yeah, but I don't want to sit here drawing. It's going to take too much time up.
Okay.
But he is to the left and just off of the sidewalk. He was standing in the grass itself.
James Files there, the Grassy Knoll assassin, hired by the CIA, the FBI, and Lyndon Johnson to murder President Kennedy back in 1963. And more from him in future weeks. That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly podcast and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston and St Albans. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week. She was working as a CIA spy in the run-up to the Iraq War and author of Extreme Prejudice about her experience. Susan Lindauer. Also, the interview with James Files, the Grassy Knoll assassin. Also, thanks to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, who are just off Jamaica Street. They're on 0117 909 6897. Or on the web at prsc.org.uk. You can also contact us through Volunteering Bristol. So that was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihe Razazan.
And I'm Khalil Bendib. Since the first wave of popular uprisings in 2011, the euphoria of the historic mass upheavals in the Middle East and North Africa has given way to mayhem and war, destruction and displacement. This week we bring you an exclusive interview with Professor Gilbert Achkar of the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London about his new book, Morbid Symptoms, Relapse in the Arab Uprising. Stay with us.
More than 5 years after the stunning, hopeful, and historic mass revolts across the Middle East and North Africa, various counter-revolutionary forces and the lingering effects of the devastating U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 have turned the region into fractured spaces of war, destruction, and displacement. In his latest book, Morbid Symptoms, Relapse in the Arab Uprising, Professor Achkar assesses in detail the current stage of the uprising as well as the main obstacles, both regional and international, preventing any resolution. He argues that in Syria, the regime's brutality has fostered the rise of jihadist forces, among which the so-called Islamic State has emerged as the most ruthless and powerful. In Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood's year in power was ultimately terminated by the contradictory conjunction of a second revolutionary wave and a bloody reactionary coup. Achkar argues that short of radical social change from the bottom up, the region will not reach stability anytime soon. Gilbert Achkar is Professor of Development Studies and International Relations at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London, and he spoke with Khalil Bendib about his new book, Morbid Symptoms, Relapse in the Arab Uprising.
Gilbert Achkar, welcome back to Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. It's great to have you with us tonight.
Thank you, Khalil. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
In your new book, Morbid Symptoms, Relapse in the Arab Uprising, as in your previous book, you describe what you call the patrimonial nature of many current Arab states, with ruling families virtually owning the state. This both in overt monarchical systems, such as the Gulf countries, most of them, Jordan, Morocco, and in the so-called modern republics, for most of them, that succeeded colonialism, as in Syria, for example. Develop this concept for us again and explain what made it possible historically when most other societies in the world have managed to transcend the old idea of patrimonial succession, or at least some of them have constitutional monarchies, as in Europe and Japan. What is it historically that's been holding back the Middle East and North Africa region for so long?
Let me start by saying that this is a feature that is not often noticed or underlined in the literature on Arab countries. I mean, even the scholarly literature, political science or whatever, they would just project on the region the general category, which is called neo-patrimonial, which is used for instance, sub-Saharan African states, some Asian states, or even some Latin American, depending on the historical period, which means something that is halfway between the old type of states that were prevailing in pre-modern times, in which the ruling dynasty families used to own the state apparatus, consider it their private property with no boundaries between the private and public property. So between that and, let's say, the modern state where this separation is very sharp, in political science they describe as neo-patrimonial something that is halfway between these two conditions, which is the case of many countries in the global south, where you have nepotism, despotism, crony capitalism, the term is also used. So rulers who take advantage of their presence in government to get their family and friends and all that rich. Huh? We know that this is quite common as a kind of pattern. What those who just use this concept of neo-patrimonial, applying it to the Arab countries, were missing the key issue here, which is that in many Arab countries, not all Arab countries, but in several Arab countries, as you mentioned, that's the case of all the monarchies and some of the republics or so-called republics, like Syria, like Gaddafi's Libya, like Saddam Hussein's Iraq, just these examples. What you have is actually not new in any way, but rather the plain type of patrimonial, that is pre-modern kind of regimes with families owning the state, behaving as if the state was their private ownership. As for the reason for that, I think the initial reason is besides the fact that the colonial powers have fostered in the region this kind of monarchies. If you look at the main stronghold of these monarchies, which is the Gulf Cooperation Council, this is a number of statelets built around oil fields by British colonialism, by British imperialism. And of course, creating those such tiny states around the oil fields had a very obvious purpose, which is better to control them and better to exploit, plunder the resources. And then you have the Saudi Kingdom, the only Gulf monarchy, which from the start built close relations not with Britain but with the United States of America. And there was actually a kingdom that was very closely protected and even run for a long period of time when it comes to the economy and such things by the United States. And again, fostering such a monarchy in that area, protecting it from the winds of Arab nationalism, of republicanism. You wouldn't imagine a coup in the Saudi Kingdom like you had in Iran, for instance, or a Republican elections or whatever, as you had in Iran in the early 50s. You wouldn't imagine that because you have this very tight control of the country by the dynasty, the ruling dynasty, and completely backed in this regard by the United States and by what was for many decades until the 70s, a kind of U.S. enclave within the kingdom, which was the Arab American Oil Company, in which you had U.S. majors, oil majors. So you have, therefore, a system that was created in connection with the exploitation of oil resources, which were seen and are still extremely strategic resources. And this stronghold, these kind of monarchies, one could say, contaminated in some way the surrounding countries where you had dictatorships, which started as military dictatorships, and in which progressively, which is the general tendency of dictatorships in the region, is to shift from what can be called neo-patrimonial, as is the general pattern, the most common pattern, into what I call patrimonialization, that is, development in which progressively you have radical reshaping of the state in order to turn it into the private property of the ruling group. They reshape the state, they reshape the repressive apparatus, a whole section of it becomes a private guard of the ruling family. And so you have this progressive process that goes on and has gone on in the last decades in the region, therefore producing this very specific feature peculiar to the Arab region. You don't find it in any other part of the world, such a concentration of states which are owned by a ruling group, a ruling family.
Families with flags, as my friend Hatem Bezian would call them here.
Yeah, definitely.
In your book, Morbid Symptoms, Relapse in the Arab Uprising, you also take to task some of the left in the West. To put it bluntly, and I agree with you, left thinkers the world over tend to get a hard on the mere mention of revolution. And God knows, Arab dictators are never shy to use the word to portray themselves as guardians of their nations against Western imperialism and Zionism. The left has been known to romanticize despotic and anti-democratic regimes such as Gaddafi's, Assad, etc., and even the theocracy in Iran, leaving democratic struggles in those lands to the tender mercies of often sometimes genocidal regimes, as we've seen in Syria, for example. The American left often seems to think the enemy of my enemy is my friend, their principal enemy being their own government. And anything that the U.S. government decides is by definition has to be opposed. Explain why this is not always the case, why it's not always helpful.
Yes, indeed. You have a trend in the left, not only in Western countries. Of course, you find it very much in Latin America, actually, with the kind of positions that Chavez...
Yes, Hugo Chavez was also supporting Gaddafi, among others.
Right.
Yes.
Indeed, these positions are based on a very flawed logic, which can be summarized, well-known formula, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And therefore, anyone opposing the United States becomes someone which is seen as good and worthy of support, regardless of the nature of these regimes, of the relation of these rulers to their people. You know, if a ruler is opposed by the United States, this ruler becomes a friend, even though this ruler might be a tyrant, oppressing their own people. That's exactly the case of many of those people who are in the region, in the Arab region, and with whom there were, let's say, either ambiguous or very bad positions in sectors of the left. And of course, the most blatant case after that of Gaddafi, larger scale, I should say, is Bashar al-Assad of Syria. The key point here is, I mean, if you define yourself as left, what do you mean by that? Is the left defined by opposing the United States in whatever the U.S. does? Or is the left defined positively, not negatively, and positively means by the defense of values, you know, democracy, equality, social equality, gender equality, the end of exploitation, or social justice, if you want to call it. So if the left is defined by such values, then you determine your position in this light. The issue of what's the stance of the United States becomes secondary.
That's right.
Otherwise, if you determine your position just as a negative of what the U.S. does, then you end up supporting this kind of tyrants.
One perfect example, as you were saying, example of this schizophrenia, is what happened in Libya. A lot of the left, and even now some on the right, are lamenting the loss of the Gaddafi regime, which at least was capable of maintaining the functioning rudiments of a state.
Well, this is what they say. I mean, you had an explosion. You have to ask yourself, first of all, why did the situation explode?
Exactly.
And it did explode, obviously, because of the people having become fed up after 40 years of totalitarian dictatorship by someone who, moreover, was seen by his own population and the rest of the world as crazy. Completely not the ruler, you know. And there are plenty of stories about Gaddafi. They may make us laugh, but for those who were suffering from that, it was no laughing matter. When people tell you, well, at least when he was there, there was a state and no chaos, that's a complete non sequitur. That's complete absurdity. Because if there is chaos, if it has exploded, it is because of what he was doing. He has been doing for so long, for so many decades. It's a totally flawed kind of logic that leads people to use this example. The other kind of thing that you may hear is when people contrast Libya and Syria, you will hear people telling you, well, had the United States intervened in Syria as it did in Libya, Syria would be today like Libya.
As if it was
anywhere better today.
Right.
I mean, the reality is that the situation in Syria is far worse than anything you have in Libya.
Yes. Just to play devil's advocate a little bit more, what do you say to those Pan-Africans who saw Gaddafi as a sincere symbol of African unity, and who were obviously willing to sacrifice the welfare of Libyan democracy for the ideal of African unity?
Very easy. I mean, if anyone believes in African unity, this person should actually be quite glad that there is no longer someone like Gaddafi to downgrade the meaning of such a perspective. the fact that someone like Gaddafi could emerge as the herald of African unity is very, very bad news for African unity. If African unity is to be based on such despots, it's a disaster.
Yeah.
African unity or any kind of regional unity is something that should be the result of a movement of the populations, of the people, not of despots, yeah. Especially one that changed tack just because of mood. One period he was for Arab unity, another he was Islamic, and the third time he becomes African. He buys the allegiance of some tribal leader from Africa, he brings them to Libya to pay allegiance to him as the King of Kings. This is so grotesque and so ridiculous that anyone mourning Gaddafi is someone who can't be taken seriously if this someone pretends to have any connection with the left, with left-wing values.
Someday maybe we should organize some kind of a debate, because they're really some of these progressive, otherwise progressive Pan-Africanists here in this country are really ruining the day that Gaddafi fell. But worse than even the Libyan case, as you were saying a few minutes ago, is the horror unfolding in Syria. It's been unfolding for too long now, starting sixth year, which many believe has been cynically aided and abetted not only by Iran and Russia on the one side, but also by the West's lack of assistance on the other side. You make a strong case in your book that the West is also responsible for the continuing genocide of his own people by Bashar Assad, and for even the emergence of ISIS in some ways. Again, most analysts on the left will disagree that the West should have been involved at all.
The United States is very much involved in Syria, but not in the way that the people you are referring to believe.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the main intervention of the United States in the Syrian case has been to prevent delivery of sensitive weapons to the Syrian opposition. That is, the Syrian opposition from the beginning of the civil war, has been requesting very urgently defensive weapons to counter the overwhelming superiority of the regime in firepower. And they needed, above all, anti-aircraft weapons, because that was the main military edge of the regime. And the United States very, very categorically vetoed any such deliveries by any of its regional allies, and that includes Turkey and all the Gulf countries. They were prevented from delivering any such weapons to the Syrian opposition. And this is the key factor that allowed Bashar al-Assad to carry on militarily and to destroy the country. I mean, the country has been devastated and the population has been massacred, appallingly massive scale, 500,000 people killed, not to mention all the other casualties that the people crippled for life, not to mention, the displaced persons, the refugees, and all that. And the destruction has been, most of the destruction has been perpetrated with the Air Force. And who has Air Force in Syria but the regime? And now, of course, with a Russian Air Force supporting the regime. The Western Air Force in Syria target only ISIS, and that is something that the regime does not even protest against. I mean, there is a kind of green light or approval by the regime of Western action against ISIS in Syria and Iraq. That the regime doesn't mind as long as the U.S. is keen on not harming the regime, hit on regime targets, only ISIS, whereas Russia has been heavily involved in bombing the opposition, all the opposition for the sake of the regime.
Why the tacit alliance almost between the Russians and the Syrian government on the one hand, and this laissez-faire attitude, not just laissez-faire, it's actual complicity on the part of ostensible opponents, enemies, the United States and the West?
The question is even more warranted when you think of the third factor that you didn't mention, which is Iran. Iran is massively involved to the side of the Syrian regime.
Yes.
Without Iran, the regime would have collapsed a long time ago. Iran is running the show in Damascus. Anyone believing that Bashar al-Assad takes decision is just... Those who are running the show in Damascus are the Iranians. The Iran funds Bashar al-Assad, and fights for in defense of the regime through its regional auxiliaries. So Hezbollah from Lebanon,
yes,
intervened massively in the war in Syria. Shia forces from Iraq are also intervening massively, and you have a kind of forced recruitment of Afghan Shia among the Afghan refugees in Iran to send them to Syria. And all this, I mean, with all these forces, Iran has shored up the regime since, especially since 2013, when the regime was about to tumble, to fall. Iran's massive intervention is what allowed the regime to survive and launch a counteroffensive. And again, in 2015, despite all that, the regime again was in a difficult situation, and that's when Russia intervened in the summer of 2015, and since then Russia has been involved there, despite Putin at some point proclaiming mission accomplished, we are leaving. We can see now that this was a pure lie. I mean,
so beyond just the lack of assistance to the other side, to the democratic forces, those who are trying to get rid of Bashar al-Assad, you're actually seeing a sort of complicity. They've actually kept those people from actually being effective. And why is that?
I want to insist on the fact that it's not only lack of assistance, it's prevention. It's preventing others from assisting.
So why is that?
This is a direct intervention.
Right. So why is this?
I mean, Turkey or the Gulf countries would have given to the Syrian opposition the armament it needs for the type of armament that I mentioned because of U.S. red line, U.S. veto.
But why are they keeping the armament from going to
for a simple reason, which is summarized usually by referring to the so-called lessons of Iraq. That is, Obama himself, who is someone who had been opposed to the invasion of Iraq, is proud of this position, and actually rightly so, because this invasion was a disaster. But the common wisdom about this invasion of Iraq is that the major blunder was the dismantling of the Iraqi state, the Ba'athist state in Iraq. And this common wisdom believes that it would have been better to keep the state apparatus and just remove the head, Saddam, put in place someone willing to cooperate with Washington and the West in general. And therefore, the view is, if we dismantle states in this part of the world, what we'll get is Al-Qaeda, because that's what you got in Iraq. I mean, the invasion, the dismantling of the Iraqi state and all that opened the way for Al-Qaeda to build a territorial base for itself in Iraq. That's the first time Al-Qaeda managed to seize some territory in the Arab region. And therefore, that has become a kind of obsession, not to dismantle the state. Contrary to what most people have believed, the intervention in Libya was not aimed at repeating Iraq. I mean, and you can't, for one second, Barack Obama, who opposed the invasion of Iraq, would want to do what he opposed in Iraq, would want to do it in Libya. And, of course, you can't do it, first of all, without boots on the ground, and that was out of the question in Libya anyway. But they intervened in Libya in order to try to hijack the uprising, because this is an oil country, so it's important strategically. They tried to hijack the uprising. Washington, and even more so Paris and London, are very much involved in all that, trying to hijack the uprising and push it towards some kind of compromise. They wished that Gaddafi's son, Saif al-Islam, the one seen in the West as a nice guy, would manage to convince his father to step down and hand him the helm of government, in which case they would have imposed on the Libyan opposition to enter into a compromise. And this failed miserably. This failed miserably because of the insurrection in Tripoli, which actually took NATO by surprise. I mean, they didn't expect the state, the whole state apparatus, to collapse in the way it did. So that became a second failure after that of Iraq. Iraq was, of course, a major disaster, and Libya became a second failure or disaster, if you want, seen from the U.S. perspective, albeit of a much lesser scale, of course, than what you have in Iraq. And therefore, this reinforced this attitude of caring for the state to remain in place, and that's the guiding attitude of Barack Obama when it comes to Syria. From the beginning, he has been saying, well, Bashar al-Assad should step down, but he should step down for a compromise, keeping the state and putting or creating some kind of coalition government of the regime and the opposition. And that's what Barack Obama, called the Yemen solution. He was referring, in 2012, he said what is needed for Syria is the Yemen solution. And he was referring to the agreement in late 2011 in Yemen, whereby the local despot handed over the presidency to the vice president. He signed a deal with a big smile, and he remained in the country controlling major sections of the state and of power in the country. And this Yemen solution in 2012 was the reference of Barack Obama, and we can see now where it led.
Another failure.
The civil war in Yemen involves the forces linked to the previous president, the one that was overthrown by the uprising in 2011. And he is the main force, actually, in igniting the civil war, and the Houthis, those local sectarian militias that the media point to, are just part of the picture, actually. The forces linked to the previous despot are more important. So this kind of solution is what Barack Obama was advocating, and they are still advocating. And even with Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, She says it very clearly in her memoir of that experience. She said, we all agreed on the necessity to keep the state in Syria, to preserve the state. The only disagreement that existed in the administration was part of the administration, including her, believed that, well, if in order to bring Bashar al-Assad to accept a compromise, he should be put in a difficult situation militarily. He should fear for his government, for his regime, and that would compel him to accept a compromise. Whereas Barack Obama refused to give this support to the opposition, even a measured support. I mean, Clinton was probably still in favor of a measured support to the opposition to change the balance of forces in a way that would compel Bashar al-Assad to compromise. That's the key point. That's the kind of discussion they have. But none of them wants, you know, a regime change. And you hear this formula, but regime change is dead since Iraq. I mean, this has been so disastrous for the United States. Just think of it. Iraq is a country that the U.S. invaded in order to control it and exploit its resources. And the United States had to leave that country in 2011 and leave it under Iranian control. I mean, it is Iran, the arch enemy of the United States in the region, which is controlling Iraq nowadays. So you see the depths of the failure, of the disaster. And, well, that's what is behind their whole attitude today in Syria, and especially when it comes to Barack Obama. This is what is guiding him, but he is facing this contradiction because he wants a compromise, but he doesn't want to create the conditions for this compromise through the change of the balance of forces. So what remains? What remains is that he relies on Moscow. He relies on Moscow. I mean, it's obvious that the United States accepted the Russian intervention and did not do anything to block it. It is obvious that, I mean, just read the newspapers. You'll see every day that Kerry, you know, begging Lavrov, his Russian counterpart, to exert pressure on Bashar al-Assad for a compromise. That's the kind of perspective you have. And definitely not what some people depict out of ignorance or you know, that Washington is heavily involved in regime change in Syria. This is a counter-truth. It's not because Washington is anything nice. It's not the problem is not here, but it's a lack of understanding of the rationale of U.S. imperialist policy in the Middle East nowadays.
That's Professor Gilbert Ashkar of the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London, speaking with Khalid Bendi about his new book, Morbid Symptoms, Relapse in the Arab Uprising. Ashkar argues that short of radical social changes, the region sadly will not reach stability anytime soon. We'll hear more of that conversation after a short break. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
Explain in your book, Morbid Symptoms, Relapse in the Arab Uprising, that unlike most revolutions, the Arab Spring ran into not one, but two counter-revolutions. Please explain.
Yes, I mean, this is for historical reasons. This is a part of the world where since the 70s we have seen the gradual development and build-up of currents of Islamic fundamentalist character. I mean, at the beginning, used by the various regimes as a counterweight to the left, and then later on acquiring dynamics of their own and becoming in various countries the main force of opposition. And these currents are, by their nature, their political, social, programmatic nature, very reactionary currents. And in that sense, they are as much antithetic, as much hostile to the core aspiration of the young people who did the uprising in 2011, as much as the regimes themselves. And so you have this, again, this very peculiar feature of the situation in the region, where unlike most cases of revolutionary processes in history, where you usually have two camps, I mean a kind of binary opposition between revolution and counter-revolution, counter-revolution being the old regime, what you have in the Arab case is not one counter-revolution, but two counter-revolutionary camps, that of the old regimes on the one hand, and that of those Islamic fundamentalist forces on the other hand. And various shades of them, from the Muslim Brotherhood, which used to be the most important, the only one with a fully regional extension. They have branches everywhere, and there are strong forces everywhere, except when now they are being heavily repressed, like in Egypt. So you have this situation where instead of a binary opposition, it is triangular. You have a triangular struggle or triangular situation where you have one revolutionary pole, which unfortunately is the weakest because it's the one that was most oppressed, the only one that didn't have any foreign support or anything like that in the past.
Okay, tell us, for example, on Egypt, take Egypt as an example. What happened post 2011 is perfect illustration of what you're saying.
Yes, so you have the left with the liberal forces, progressive liberal forces. This is kind of progressive camp we can regard as the revolutionary pole, and it's faced with not one counter-revolutionary pole, but two, the old regime forces and those Islamic fundamentalist forces. And what happened is that the progressive camp, instead of clearing a path of its own, equally opposed to both counter-revolutionary poles, has actually, instead of doing that, the progressive forces have actually oscillated between the two counter-revolutionary poles, allying with one against the other and then with the former against the latter. You know, I mean, shifting alliances within the two poles. And the result of this has been a relative marginalization of the progressive forces in the region. Everywhere we have seen that, even though at some point they had much greater influence, they played a key role in the uprisings themselves and all that, they got marginalized with time because of the lack of assertive progressive policies. And their game of allying with this or that pole of the counter-revolution produced the result in which actually they receded to the background, and what came to the fore has been the clash between the two counter-revolutionary poles. And that is exactly what prevails in the region today, whether you look at Libya or Syria or Yemen, for that matter, or Egypt or any country of the region. You see that this clash now between the old regimes and the Islamic fundamentalist forces is the prominent feature. It is more important than any role of the progressive forces. But that's because of their missing the train, if you want. Their misbehavior politically, their major blunder or error of not asserting their independent line. Now, this created also a situation in which today Washington's main concern in the region is to try to reconcile the two counter-revolutionary poles, because their clash is the dominant feature, and it is destabilizing the whole region. So what Washington and its European allies are trying to do is to bring these two poles to some kind of reconciliation and get them work together and form coalition governments. And that's what you have. That's what you see in Syria, in Libya, everywhere. In Yemen, you have these negotiations fostered by Western powers attempting to produce compromises in these countries. The only country where this succeeded until now, I mean, among the countries where you had uprisings, is Tunisia, where you had a coalition government of the old regime and the Islamic fundamentalist force. And among the countries where you didn't have an uprising, you can point to Morocco, where also this kind of, I mean, this collaboration between the regime and the Islamic fundamentalist has been decisive in killing in the bud, if you want, the revolutionary dynamics that had started in 2011. So no. This is the kind of line that Washington is promoting in the region. Now, I should say that given the conditions, one can only wish that they succeed in reconciling these counter-revolutionary forces, because it is better to have these counter-revolutionary forces allied in government than to have them clash with each other, thus pushing the progressive to the margin. So when they are in a coalition government, as in Tunisia, for instance, then the left is forced to adopt the correct position of being against both. That's what you have there, where the left is positioned to the coalition government. This is what basically what can explain the shift from the revolutionary phase of 2011-2012, the shift starting from 2013 into a counter-revolutionary phase. That's why my subtitle of the book is Relapse.
Yes.
In the Arab Uprising. Yes. It's a relapse. It's a comeback of the old regime with a vengeance, or this clash of counter-revolutionary forces becoming dominant. And we are very much in this kind of situation today. Now, one can only wish that, as I said, these forces reach some kind of agreement between them, the counter-revolutionary forces, in order to allow this revolutionary potential that emerged very powerfully in 2011 and that has not been crushed. It is still everywhere, even though it has been marginalized politically. But as a social force, it is very much there. It needs only a renewal in the political conditions, enabling them to reemerge as a driving force of the situation. That is very much the summary, if you want, of the present situation.
What you're saying is that the genie is out of the bottle. and you can't push it back?
No, you can't, because what started 2011, I said from the beginning, is a long-term revolutionary process which will take very long time, several decades probably, before reaching any kind of new stable course for the region, because the problems are much deeper than just constitutions or whatever. You have a problem of a rotten social economic structure which needs a very radical change, and in order to do that, of course, you need a radical change in the nature of the state and government. And for this to happen, you need the emergence of progressive forces capable of implementing this, and that will take a long time. This won't happen easily. That will need a long time to happen, and if it doesn't happen, because nothing is certain absolutely in this regard, then the prospect for the region is really frightening. Then the region will be condemned to more and more of the worst case scenario that we have seen unfolding in the last few years. That's the kind of crossroad that the region stands.
So this inability so far to grasp this opening that happened in 2011, and that was followed in Egypt and Tunisia by legitimate elections for the first time, the failure of the progressive forces to coalesce and organize and create something new that might represent perhaps the majority of the people, this failure you don't attribute to a fatalistic situation where some Orientalists, for example, might say that, well, there's not much to expect there. They're conservative, whether they're pro-Islamist, so-called Islamist, or just crony capitalists on the other side, you know, a clan, a family. You see, despite this temporary fragmentation and inability, you see a hope for that third way to actually represent and transcend in the end the democratic ideals.
I mean, first of all, yes, indeed, there's nothing written in the sky about what is happening. There's no determination of that. It's very much a matter of political choices. And the agency of these forces is very real. And anyone believing that it was fatal is denying them this agency. These are forces that have a political responsibility. And as I said, they behave very poorly. That's the truth. In every single Arab country, I'll give you examples of the way the progressive forces misbehaved in shifting from one alliance to another instead of opposing the two counter-revolutionary forces. Take the example of Egypt, of course, which is one very obvious instance of that, where the most popular progressive figure in the country was the Nasserist Hamdine Sabah.
Yes.
He started by allying with the Muslim Brotherhood in 2011. He made an electoral alliance with them, and he ended up in 2013 supporting the army in the coup against the Muslim Brotherhood. So he shifted radically from one pole to the other. And it's only between in this trajectory at some point when he stood at equal distance from both and ran in the presidential election in 2012 against both the Muslim Brotherhood and the army, that he got extraordinary massive vote. Some 20% of the vote, with a small margin with the two others, with very limited means compared to them, and with a plurality of vote, I mean the largest number of votes in Cairo and Alexandria. So that was amazing. That showed the potential, and this potential is still there, except that now, instead of being expressed positively by a vote for some figure which the people see as embodying their aspirations, as they did in 2012, the lack of that, and because this same figure burned himself in alliance with the army in 2013, in the last elections, you see very, very, very low rate of electoral participation, especially the youth. Over 70% of the youth under 30 abstained from the vote. This shows you that this potential, this youth that did the uprising 2011, is still there, but it is the lack of political expression that they can see as representing them that is keeping them away for the time being. But I'm confident that whenever this radical alternative, radical progressive alternative, will reemerge, it will reattract this potential. The potential is there. As I said, it has not been crushed. Even Syria, where you had the most terrible situation, even Syria, those young people who were the driving force of the uprising in 2011, many of them are in exile today. Others are in the country, but they can't do much in a situation where you have this war dynamics between the regime and mostly Islamic fundamentalist forces, not only, but mostly facing it. Or some of them are in jail, but they are still around, especially those who are in exile. In some way, this is preserving them. Mm. One can hope that someday there will be peace again. The war will stop in this country and they will go back and resume their political struggle, as happened actually even at a small scale when you had the ceasefire recently. You saw the resumption of demonstrations in several cities and villages in Syria. So this points to this potential. Potential, again, is still there. So there is reason for hope. Hope is not optimism. Major difference. Hope means that there is a potential, but this potential needs action to be translated in facts. Optimism is the belief that the conditions will produce a positive outcome by themselves, and that's far from being a view that is possible in the region. To be frank, there's no reason for optimism, obviously, when you look at things today. But there is still a strong reason for hope, and that will depend on the behavior, on the political shrewdness of the progressive forces.
And these people, by being displaced, as you said, they're actually, in a way, being forced to make connections outside of Syria, connections that are grassroots as opposed to the two reactionary poles that are being helped from outside powers, from outside interests. As you were saying, the one direction that's not being encouraged by any government outside is the one that represents the people more authentically.
The revolutionary aspirations,
right,
of course.
Yeah.
It's not in the interest of the United States or any
right.
of the powers dominating the region, from Russia to
Saudi Arabia,
by way of Europe and all that. None of these countries who wishes to see real democratic governments and really progressive governments in the region, because any real democratic or progressive governments would be opposed to the domination of these countries by such powers.
What you're saying, it reminds me of an anecdote that happened to me, a little something. I was being interviewed by a couple of French journalists for a book that came out in France, and this was in 2011, and they're already asking me back then, how come the Egyptian revolution is taking so long to conclude? And I asked them how, and we happened to be sitting in the cafe Place de la Bastille, of all places, one Place de la Bastille, and asked them, how long did it take you, the French, to complete your revolution?
Of course.
Said, well, about 100 years.
Yeah.
So I told them, so why do you expect it to be completed in 3 months in Egypt?
Exactly.
Gilbert Oshkar is a professor of developmental studies and international relations at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. He's the author of several books on the Middle East, including The People Want, A Radical Exploration of the Arab Uprising, and his most recent, Morbid Symptoms, Relapse in the Arab Uprising. He spoke with Khalil Bendib. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. We hear Iraqi novelist and poet Professor Sinan Antoun reading a poem by Amjad Nasser, one of the most celebrated Iraqi poets writing in Arabic today. He has published 10 collections of poetry, 4 travel memoirs, and the novel Land of No Rain. His work has been translated into 10 languages.
Questioning Ibn Arabi by Amjad Nasser, translated by Sinan Antoun. 1. From Sevilla to Damascus, where I plunge through the scents of Al Salhiya's kitchens and the voices of its persistent sellers until I found you. The sky might be one and the same, with clouds raining here and refraining there, with angels absorbed in arranging a mercy that does not arrive, or with migrating birds whose craws carry the shots of pursuing guns, others carrying the hay of their original homes in their beaks, making winter meet summer. The stars stay up, guarding their dust-covered silver. Someone is counting the money of wakefulness with his hands, and someone is sleeping by the night's full eye. Two, the earth may be one and the same, people swaying toward night and day, with no time to feel or even care for this tiring pendulum from which no one disembarks except he for whom all extending ghosts of loss, power, satisfaction, and anger are equal. How can those descending from the clay mountain and the heavy water of lust like us have such measures? The earth, as it is said, turns. It turns, and humans, with unconcealed cunning, dodge messengers carrying letters they do not wish to receive. But destiny's trackers, and they cannot be misguided. Three, if that which cannot be felt should not be desired, and vice versa, why then did you try to hide the spot of the hand that etched the shape of its soft fingers on the implied pronouns in your poems, and to try to mix the voice you kept hearing as you were about to deliver what you were given with voices that cultivated their huskiness in praise poems? So you tended to the yearning dripping off your hands with interpretation. The beloved's mouth became God's mouth, when we know it's the mouth of the Persian girl whose young beauty shook you, and you went on disclosing what a master of secrets such as you should not do. Four, you are the master of the secret. Concealment is the youngest of your disciples, but the master of the secret loves, like the one who is exposed by butterflies as they fly out of his mouth whenever he opens it. Five, I would like to believe, my master, that the mercy you promise us has room for everything, including he who rejects it, and that existence in its entirety palpitates in the woodworm that gnaws on the spear and the reed flute, and that when we put a trembling hand on a hand that yearns, we are putting it on God's hand, and that the unity of existence is something else, not this metallic humming that envelops the universe. Six, but do you know what is good about the matter? It is that you are here under the water wheel of sounds and scents, without water or electricity. Just as the Damascenes, you are not in a retreat in the desert or a mountaintop. People go into you and come out, wearing head covers, scarves, black flowing pants, dish dashes. They smell of their houses, their livestock, pungent Syrian tobacco. I saw Spaniards, Italians, and some Englishmen in your shrine, holding maps and booklets full of footnotes. But the residents of Medaris Street, reeling under clouds of fuel smoke and the slogans of the One Party, need no guide to know you. Your daily visitors, with their quick prostrations and your green substance, never wore your cloak, nor did they read your Meccan revelations. They do not know the link between your divine geometry and Dante Alighieri. They simply call you Sheikh Muhyiddin. poem is by Iraqi poet Salah Faik, entitled On the 10th Anniversary of Murdering My Country. My country disappeared without a funeral because it shunned the beauty of palm trees. It avoided its marshes, thought that mountains were secrets. They looted the tablets of the first kingdom with gigantic ships. Now they are covered with spiders, its springs, fruit, and books are scattered among the hills of salt. Untitled. After months of pain, I took x-rays of my chest. The images astonished me. Moroccans dancing. A Jew from my childhood is selling fabric in an alley. Charlie Chaplin is sitting with my father in the guest room, where father hid his clean dinars. Children are watching a man from the countryside cry in the market. I am waiting outside an airport, even though it is closed. There are animals, some of them wild, scattered in these images. I sit among them and read a short story.
Listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Who's Counting? Marilyn Waring on Sex, Lies, and Global Economics. A classic from the film and radio archives of TUC Radio.
The more that you smoke cigarettes, or the more that you have automobile accidents, the more growth increases. Now, I'd be fairly unlikely, having smashed my car, to come home and say, darling, don't worry about it, we've just contributed to the national income of the country.
That's the voice of Marilyn Waring, author of a book on women in the world economy entitled If Women Counted. To this day, a persuasive and vivid argument against endless economic growth. At age 22, Marilyn Waring became the youngest member of the New Zealand Parliament. In her second term, she was appointed chair of the prestigious Public Expenditures Committee. There, she became familiar with the gross domestic product system and decided to disclose its pathologies in a film, her teachings at AUT University in Auckland, and really her life as a feminist economist. After 9 years in Parliament, Waring precipitated the 1984 elections by threatening to vote for the opposition-sponsored nuclear-free New Zealand legislation. Prime Minister Muldoon said that Waring's feminist anti-nuclear stance threatened his ability to govern. Marilyn Waring resigned from Parliament and began traveling the world to explore how the fate of women and of the earth are irrevocably tied up with the deadly pursuit of economic growth. Much of her quest is recounted in the 94-minute documentary by the Canadian filmmaker Terry Nash. This radio program presents over half of the soundtrack of the movie, because in addition to being a beautiful film, it is a compelling, intriguing, and very intelligent explanation of the GDP system and possible alternatives. Since released in 1996, the film had minimal exposure because the distributor charged so much. However, now it has finally become accessible online from the National Film Board of Canada's website, www.nfb.ca. Marilyn Waring speaking at a public meeting in Canada.
The more that you have automobile accidents, the more growth increases. I wouldn't run my household like that, and I can't think like that. I would consider that a loss, you know. I would kind of consider that a debit. A cost, not a benefit. National income accounting doesn't have a debit side. As long as the activity passes through the market, it's good for growth. Let me give you a very easy example. The voyage of the Exxon Valdez. Now, the Exxon Valdez is most likely the most productive oil tanker voyage ever known on the face of the planet. Now, if it had simply loaded up its oil in Alaska and made its way down the west coast and discharged into a bunker, it would have been a moderately productive voyage in economic terms. But if you want to have fantastic growth, it's a very good idea to ram your tanker into an iceberg. Immediately there are the insurance costs and the new tanker. This is great for growth. Then there are the civil legal proceedings and the criminal legal proceedings. Immediately, of course, there's the payment for the cleanup operation. Then down the way a little bit, there are the compensations to fisher people and the compensations to the tourist industry. And of course, there is the film, the television rights, the book, the various newspaper and media exercises that go on. A fantastically productive oil tanker voyage. It all added to growth. Nobody stood there and said, "Dearie me, just lost an oil tanker. Better subtract that from the national income accounts."
I think most economists place a affirmative value on being incomprehensible. There's some exceptions to that. John Kenneth Galbraith, for instance, writes comprehensibly. But Marilyn, because her goal is to be understood, she understands very well that if people don't have the information, they can't act on it.
In Canada, we've signed a free trade agreement with the United States and Mexico. We hear that it's a whole question of productivity. This is going to be good for economies. This is going to boost our GNP. We look across to Europe, and the same thing is happening in Europe. The Maastricht Treaty is signed, and all these countries are saying, well, yeah, this will be great. We'll be coming together. This will be good for our economies. How does someone like you react to that?
Well, it might change GDP figures, but you're starting from the wrong premise. I mean, all of these decisions were based on the wrong figures in the first place. For 10, 20 years, we've had these cliches, we've heard this rhetoric, you know, inside or outside discussions on free trade. You tell us things are getting better. It's perfectly obvious to us. Our air is getting worse. Our education systems are failing the poorest people. There is more poverty. There is more homelessness. There are more housing crises. And I suspect that the unease that is in Canada and in the United States, and let me tell you, in Mexico, about NAFTA has to do with the fact that it doesn't matter what they say, GDP might grow up, but GDP is utterly unrelated to the well-being of a community. It tells you nothing about levels of poverty. It tells you nothing about the distribution of poverty. It tells you nothing about primary health care, educational standards, environmental cleanliness. And folks have realized that this unidimensional economic fabrication just doesn't bear any relationship to their lives. It was 1975. It was International Women's Year. I was 22 years old. And I put my name in, and sort of 6 weeks later, with some horror, recognised that I'd just been chosen the candidate for a safe seat that I couldn't lose.
Honourable members of the House of Representatives, you meet here today as members of the 38th Parliament.
Marilyn Waring's no-nonsense approach to parliamentary politics earned her respect early. In just her second term, she was appointed chairperson of the prestigious Public Expenditure Committee, a position from which she aired criticism of the effectiveness of controls on government spending, the accountability of politicians, and the dead hand of bureaucracy.
In a small country like New Zealand, this is the sole budget appropriations public accounts committee of a parliament. So we review everything in terms of the whole 45 government ministries and departments and trading divisions. And I can still recall, you know, interchanges when they were briefing me in my office and they would teach me something and I would say, but that's preposterous, or that's crazy, or that's ludicrous. And they would say to me, oh, well, yes, it is, but those are the rules. And I couldn't believe that these enormous paradoxes or pathologies that I was discovering were part of an international economic system. I thought, you know, maybe it's just we make bad policy in New Zealand. Other countries started to invite me there as their guest. And when you went there, you could ask to see their chair people of public accounts committees, their treasury boards, their budget appropriations committees. And I began to realise, hey, it's nothing to do with New Zealand. These are the rules everywhere. And I developed very early a kind of, it was a personal technique, which was in any community that I went into, I'd asked until I was introduced to a woman my age.
Well, Tendai was a 14-year-old who lived in the Lerveld in Zimbabwe. And I'm interested in the work days of young women because the International Labour Organization specifies that under 14-year-olds don't work.
We're speaking of 16 to 18-hour days every day of the week. And all of the activities that they're involved in this time are unrecorded. They're called non-productive. They're called uneconomic. These women are apparently at leisure. during these enormously work-filled days.
Let me tell you about my day. In the morning, before I can wash, I must walk 5 miles to fetch water. When I get back from the well, I wash things for the children, then I cook them some food for school and for the rest of the day. Then I go to gather firewood, which I use for cooking. When I come back, I tend the sheep and goats. Around 6 o'clock, the cattle arrive, then I milk the cows. I spent my evenings worrying about how to get water for the next day. And that's how I spent my day, every day, until sunset.
And the translator asks, and what do the men do? A man in the crowd answers.
A man's day is quite hard. First, he must supervise the women and children because they all come under his authority. Then he has to decide who will herd the cattle for the day, and then he worries about how to get food for the family.
It's perfectly obvious that the people who are visible to you as contributors to the economy are the people who will be visible when you make policy. And if you're not visible as a producer in a nation's economy, then you're going to be invisible in the distribution of benefits. And wherever I was, this was the world situation for women. And at the so-called end of their working life, because they don't stop working till they die, but at that point, the government then says, well, not only have you been invisible, but now you are welfare. Now you are a dependent on the state. Now you're one of our obligations. You know, so you've got this extraordinary choice. You go from being nobody to being a problem, in spite of the fact that of all the people in the population, you just worked harder than anybody else for all those years, except you probably didn't get paid for it. It's becoming part of a global situation for me now. I mean, I'm able to make analogies between the unpaid rural women in Bangladesh or in the Philippines and the woman back in my constituency whose work is also invisible.
She too is economically inactive, and economists record her as unoccupied. Ben is a highly trained member of the US military. His regular duty is to descend to an underground facility where he waits with a colleague. When I wrote this, it was a colleague, but now, due to drug abuse in the US military, it's with two colleagues. For hours at a time, for an order to fire a nuclear missile. So skilled and effective is Ben that if his colleague were to attempt to subvert an order to fire, Ben would, if all else failed, be expected to kill him to ensure a successful missile launch.
Well, we're trained so highly in our recurring training that we take every month in simulators like this, so that if we actually had to do it, it would be an almost automatic thing. There wouldn't be time for any reflection until after we turn the keys.
Ben is in paid work. He is economically active. His work has value and contributes, as part of the nuclear machine, to the nation's growth, wealth, and productivity. Since the mid-70s, New Zealanders had begun to demonstrate against the visit of nuclear-powered or nuclear weapons-bearing ships to New Zealand. Well, the nuclear ships issue wasn't just a matter of not having nuclear weapons in New Zealand. It was a whole question of sovereignty. Here on the wharf in Wellington,
by treaty, New Zealand was prohibited to store, possess, transport, use nuclear weapons. This seemed to me to be treated with utmost contempt by a so-called ally, the United States, who would draw ships up alongside our wards, you know, that were nuclear-powered or that would have nuclear arms on them. And so if we were to do anything, the least and the only thing we could do was to ban them from New Zealand, from our territorial waters, from beside our wards. New Zealanders felt this very keenly. They didn't just feel it keenly as a peace issue. They felt it very strongly as an environmental issue.
There should be no nuclear weapons inside our sovereign territory.
Those were the words of an MP who wouldn't back down, and that was the conviction that led to the Prime Minister admitting he couldn't count on her vote on the nuclear issue.
Close to midnight and in high spirits, the Prime Minister with the announcement that shocks the nation, a snap election.
No, six, and bring them in fast.
There's a sense of urgency about Parliament by now.
I just withdrew from the government on the nuclear legislation, and it forced an urgent election.
Sir Robert blamed Waipar MP Marilyn Waring for not guaranteeing her support for his late-night ride to Government House and the dissolution of Parliament.
Quite frankly, I didn't agree with it. But there you are. It happened, and, you know, you've got to respect Marilyn for her dedication and her beliefs. And as I say, that democracy working. That's a prime example, isn't it? That, you know, one person like that can bring the government down.
She had the majority of people saying, well, good on you, Marilyn, for saying the things you are saying, and that she had a reputation for being fearless and speaking her mind, which I think was... ordinary people appreciated that very much indeed.
The election was fought on nuclear-free New Zealand, and it was a resounding victory. 72% of New Zealanders voted for it.
Did you have any doubts when you walked across that floor? You knew that the government that was in power, the government that you were a member of, could fall.
Sure. It always amazed me that that's not what members of Parliament realise they're there for. I mean, there ought to have been 86 other people sitting there thinking that. That's our job, it seemed to me. I mean, if you're elected to go represent the people, you ought to be ready at any minute, at any hour, at any day, to go on principle. It's not a job for life.
Got to stand up on high ground.
The constituency was in good hands. Catherine O'Regan had taken over my old parliamentary seat. So I had some time for intensive research, and I set off to try to unscramble the codes of global economics. When I came to New York to the UN Library, I didn't really have much idea what I expected to find. It was just that this is where the search kept leading me. Everyone kept saying, well, there are a set of rules, and they're called the United Nations System of National Accounts. And if you want to read the full set, this is where you've got to come. So it was either going to be the end of the search or the beginning of a whole new one. The United Nations Statistical Commission has annual conferences. It is certainly dominated by ideologues from the United States and works very, very closely with the World Bank and the IMF. And the difficulty is, of course, that hardly anybody from various governments' treasuries, those people who actually define macroeconomic policy, come anywhere near these conferences, have any idea what the new rules are, let alone have ever read them. When massive international rules are operating in a situation where no one who is implementing them is required to read them, then you know immediately you have a massive set of propaganda operative. But it was also so offensive, so chronically malevolent. And every day or two, I'd find yet another truly horrendous paragraph that meant I had to keep going. The worst day of all was when I discovered the paragraph, "Subsistence production and the consumption of their own produce by non-primary producers is of little or no importance." Well, after, I guess, about 2 months of reading through the system of national accounts, you can start to believe you're slightly crazed or that you're not reading things properly, because the distortions between what is in the rules and what is real life that you observe is so extreme that I kept thinking I'm still missing something. And so again, I went to talk to John Kenneth Galbraith and said to me, look, for goodness sake, write it. Stop talking about this. You've known enough. You've read enough. Just write it.
Well, I'm very proud of that. I have quite a few visits, so not all are strong in my memory, but I certainly remember her coming to see me. We had a long talk about the role of women in the economic system. The whole tendency in economics is to take the monetary economy, the pecuniary economy, not only as the basic thing to be measured. If there isn't money involved, if there isn't a price, you don't measure it. And that leaves women's work in the household and a great deal of child care and so forth out of the national accounts. It is enormously productive work, both for human enjoyment and for the welfare of the economy and the growth of the economy, that doesn't get counted. And it was this that Marilyn was concerned with, as indeed I would like to think I have been.
The system was developed by John Maynard Keynes and Richard Stone, based on a pamphlet they wrote called, literally, The British National Income and How to Pay for the War. And this became the basis of national income accounting. Stone was then recruited by the new United Nations organization to take the rules that he'd had in Britain and to enlarge upon them for international consumption. Of course, he didn't really. He just translated what was a system that suited the British Empire into a neo-colonial exercise for the whole world. And so by 1953... that set of rules was imposed on every country, including all the newly emergent independent countries. It's called the United Nations System of National Accounts, and to a significant extent, it governs all our lives. All nations must conform to these rules of economic measurement, or they cannot belong to the United Nations. They cannot borrow from the World Bank, or secure any loans from the International Monetary Fund. Important decisions are made with these figures, decisions which will determine whose needs are met first, decisions on how to spend your tax dollar, decisions on killing the planet, decisions on who will live or die. These measurements are highly selective. So what is included and excluded in this system? The system includes everything that goes through the marketplace. Everything which has a cash-generating capacity. In other words, the system recognizes no value other than money. Regardless of how that money is made. This means that there is no value to peace,
This means that there is no value to the preservation of natural resources for future generations. This means there is no value to unpaid work, including the unpaid work of reproducing human life itself, including the unpaid work of women who feed and nurture their own families. This system cannot respond to values it refuses to recognize. This system leaves out the work of half the population of the planet and the planet itself. It is the cause of massive poverty, illness, and death of millions of women and children, and it is encouraging environmental disaster. This is an economic system that can eventually kill us all.
That was the voice of Marilyn Waring in a documentary film about her ideas and her life entitled Who's Counting? Sex, Lies, and Global Economics. You heard part one of a one-hour radio program based on that film, directed by Terry Nash. You can see this film online at the website of the National Film Board of Canada, www.nfb.ca. Look for Marilyn Waring. Marilyn Waring is an author, former member of the New Zealand Parliament, and goat farmer. Since the film was released in the U.S. in 1996, she has become professor of public policy at AUT University in Auckland, New Zealand. Come back when TUC Radio returns to hear why the GDP makes war the biggest growth industry of all. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org, for the address and donate buttons. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Capitalism does not have any duration. It does not exist outside our activity. If capitalism exists today, it's not because it was created 100 or 200 years ago. If capitalism exists today, it is because people are producing it today.
Welcome to this week's edition of Latin Waves. We speak to John Holloway, author of Crack Capitalism and Changing the World Without Taking Power. He speaks about the role of the individual in perpetuating a system based on capital and consumption. As John puts it, the question we should be asking ourselves is not how do we defeat capitalism, but why do we keep reproducing it every day?
John Holloway is the author of Crack Capitalism, Change the World Without Taking Power. He's also the author of Zapatista, Rethinking Revolution in Mexico and Global Capital, National State and Politics of Money. Thank you very much for joining us today. Now, in your book, Crack Capitalism, your latest book, you argue that radical change can only come about through creation, the creation and expansion and multiplication of cracks in the capitalist system. Can you give us an example of how an average person create cracks in this system?
I think we do it all the time, in fact. As a way into talking about that, there was something that really caught my attention in the email that you sent me, where at the bottom of the email, and I suppose at the bottom of all the emails that you send, there's a quotation from Arundhati Roy, which says, "Another world is not only possible, she is on her way. On the quiet day, I can hear her breathing." I mean, that seems to me an absolutely beautiful quotation. I didn't know it at all. But it seems to me that that is what I'm trying to do in the book, to listen to the breathing of this other world, this other possible world. And I think that breathing is actually something that is present in all of us and present in our everyday lives. So I think central part of my argument is really that there is nothing special about being anti-capitalist, that we are all anti-capitalist in one way or another. I mean, some of us are very committed and conscious of being anti-capitalist. Others just see it in terms of decency, in terms of love, in terms of the way, the sort of way we want to relate to the people around us. So you can think of this other world that is breathing. You can think of it, say, in terms of the Zapatistas, who were on a very big scale and a very clear project to actually create another world here and now. But you can also think of it in terms of a gardener. I mean, somebody who just cultivates a garden in order to create a different world with a different relationship with the plants. I mean, a relationship with other forms of life that goes against the dreadful destruction of life that capitalism implies. One of the things that I say at the beginning is really that the book is the story of many, many people, of millions, perhaps billions. It is the story of the composer in London who expresses his anger and his dream of a better society through the music he composes. It is the story of the gardener in Cholula who creates a garden to struggle against the destruction of nature, of the car worker in Birmingham who goes in the evenings to his garden allotment so that he has some activity that is meaning and pleasure for him, of the indigenous peasants in Ovantik Chiapas who create an autonomous space of self-government and defend it every day against the paramilitaries who harass them, of the university professor in Athens who creates a seminar outside the university framework for the promotion of critical thought, of the friends in Porto Alegre who form a choir just because they enjoy singing, of the theater director in Vienna who decides she will use her skills to open a different world to those who see her plays, of the radio presenter in Vancouver I could have added who creates a program in order to open up other types of discussion that go against the logic of capitalism, of, the people who just try and create relations with the people around them that don't follow the logic of money, that don't follow the logic of profit. And if you think of anti-capitalism in that way, you begin to see that really all the time we're trying to break with this logic that we know is destroying the world and that we feel all the time as something oppressive and alien. You know, so that these kind of little spaces or little moments I call cracks, because they seem to be cracks in the logic of capitalist development. The processes of negation and creation, processes in which we say, no, we don't want capital. We want to create something else. So it's really going beyond shouting against the capitalists and trying to begin to create the other world that we so desperately need. But we don't do it, seems to me, on a big scale. We do it sometimes on a big scale, but lots of times we do it on a small, very small scale, just with friends, say, creating a community garden. And sometimes we just, they're not necessarily cracks in space. They can be cracks in time. You know, now in the half hour of this interview, or however long we take, you know, our concern is really how do you bring to life this other world that we can hear breathing? How do we nurture it? How do we create something different? Not how do we make money for the next half hour, no, but how do we go in a different logic? And I suppose that most of your listeners are really thinking in the same terms. The book is about how you can hear the breathing of the other world through these cracks, through these different moments of negation and creation. But not only that, also to think about the problems that they face, because although it's clear that these cracks are very inspiring and very exciting, it's also very clear that they have very big problems, precisely because they run counter to the logic of capitalist development. So I'm trying to think, on the one hand, kind of sing a song of praise, I suppose, for the cracks, and on the other hand, to think, yeah, we mustn't romanticize them too much, because they are within the context of a capitalist society that is running on a mad chase towards the destruction of humanity altogether. So how do we actually think about that clash between the two logics? And how do we nurture and give strength to the cracks that begin to open a different world?
Invariably, people are kind of associating capitalism with freedom and democracy. And this problem with using the language interchangeably really troubles me, because I don't think that this is the case. I think that the language has been co-opted. And when we talk about freedom, we are talking about choices. We're talking about market choices. And within a choice based society, those with more money have more choices. Those with wealth have power to decide, and the rest of us are not invited to the table to make decisions. So I wonder if you could focus on the myths that sustain capitalism. What are some of those myths, and what prevents us from looking beyond creating something new and imagining, as you point out, using our creativity to imagine something new?
I think that possibly the strongest myth that sustains capitalism is simply the idea that there isn't any alternative, that we can't, the idea that we can't change it. I mean, it just seems to me so obvious now that capitalism is an absolute disaster. I mean, it's an absolute disaster, not only because of the way in which it creates great inequalities, but I mean, we all know now, I think, that if we don't break with capitalism, then it is very, very likely that the human life will not last for very long. I mean, we know what capitalism and its dynamic is doing to the to nature, to the natural preconditions of our own existence. We know the sort of violence that it's creating. We know the inequality. We know the stress of, the stress that we live through at work every day. Okay, I mean, they're kind of myths of freedom and democracy, but we know also that the political system is a farce. We know that elections are not going to change things radically. We know that freedom is limited by money, that it's a farcical freedom. I suppose what I feel is perhaps what we should do is think that really most of us know that capitalism is a disaster. What we don't see is the existence of alternatives, and the existence of alternatives not only are not so much in terms of great revolutions, but the existence of alternatives in the way in which we do things every day. I mean, if we go out for a meal with friends, for example, right? This is, in many ways, normally an anti-capitalist process. I mean, not in the sense that we're going to steal the food. I mean, maybe we will, but that's not what I was thinking of. Just in the sense that we sort of discuss together democratically, well, what type of food would we like? Where will we go to eat? What time will we meet? And so on. I mean, that kind of push towards self-determination is actually part, a very deep part of our everyday lives. And it is something that runs counter to the determination of decisions by money and by profit. My feeling is that really left discourse much of the time concentrates too much on denouncing capitalism. I think that is important. I mean, I think it is important all the time to say what an awful system it is and how unjust, and to point it out in detail. But I think perhaps it's more important at the stage at which we're at the moment, it's more important to say, well, yeah, I mean, capitalism is just an awful system. Capitalism is our suicide. What are we going to do about it? Can no longer think in terms of revolution in 50 years' time. That's silly. What are we going to do about it now? How do we come out of capitalism now? How do we nurture this other society, or, you see, or other world that we can hear breathing, according to the quotation from Arundhati Roy?
One of the key components that you're describing about an alternative is to begin asking the question, if we're not going to be organized in a hierarchical way where we're abiding to some political official or someone who is elected, and by that we dismiss our own responsibility, then I guess what you're proposing is to create something where we're horizontally organized and also equally responsible for the outcomes of whatever we put in place. And the biggest obstacle to seeing a world that's not based on a hierarchy and a structure of dominance of, you know, men over women or of manager over worker, etc., is usually the idea that we can possibly organize ourselves and be able to resolve conflicts if we're all equal. How do we bridge that gap then? Because that's another, I think, obstacle that we face. That we've been so accustomed to seeing ourselves in this hierarchy, seeing the person at the top as having this almost unchallenged authority, and we give legitimacy without questioning. Why? Why do we do that? You know, could we do it differently?
I suppose three answers occur to me. Firstly, the example I gave a moment ago, I mean, just look at our own lives and look at the way we decide things in lots and lots and lots of instances is not hierarchical. We actually have a daily practice of horizontalism. We have a daily practice of trying to find common solutions together. Secondly, I think if you look at the social movements, the anti-capitalist movements, especially of the last 15, 20 years, before that as well, but it's become an important theme of the last 15, 20 years. If you look at the Zapatista movement in Chiapas, if you look at the uprising in Argentina at the beginning of the decade, if you look at movements all around the world and the way in which they are placing emphasis on developing different sorts of forms of organization precisely to encourage people to participate fully or to articulate their views fully, to reach decisions that we all share, then I think you can learn from that experience, I mean, just how well horizontal decision-making can work or does work in the vast majority of cases. And the third point, I think, is simply that we can't go, I mean, it's clear we can't go on the way we're going. Now, if we go on the way we're going, it's really quite likely that we'll destroy the world or destroy human life on the world. In some sense, we have to assume our own responsibility for the future of humanity. You know, we can no longer say, well, it's the responsibility of the leaders, it's the responsibility of the president or the prime minister or the politicians or the leader of the party or the revolutionary leaders. No, when you're kind of faced with catastrophe, then the only possible thing is to take our own responsibility.
What inspires your work?
I suppose what we all see around us is, on the one hand, a system of social cohesion, a kind of coherent system that seems to knit together so logically, so rationally, and so terribly destructively. I mean, that we want to scream. It's difficult to watch the news on television, for example, without wanting to scream. So that's on the one hand. And on the other hand, I suppose what we also see around us really all the time is struggles against this system. Fantastic struggles, lots of times, or just tiny little struggles which are also fantastic as well. I suppose that's what inspires my work. And then, yeah, obviously just thinking about that and reading about that and reading people who are thinking about that.
I was interviewing Bruce Dixon, and he was talking about how if a corporation were truly human, the corporation VP, for instance, the one responsible for the spill in the Gulf of Mexico, would be now about 120 years. And he points out how these organizations are immortal and their actions are often excluded from the responsibilities of other human beings. So as you're talking about what inspires you, as you're talking about the way we are changing, the way we are struggling, the legacy of resistance, I think about the connection, right? The connection of people becoming awakened to this world that has sort of inverted, co-opted our language and used it against us, you know, where we're giving rights to corporations to pollute and kill people openly, where we're giving a mass industry like militarism the right to use our wealth that we'd like to use for health and education to kill others and bring disaster to the lives of millions in other places, you know, people who have, like us, brothers, sisters, mothers. So it's important that we look at this stage, I think, not only as a turning point, but also as a key catalyst for what moves us to act. In your book, you call us to action. What would you ask people to do? What do you hope will come out of people reading your book?
I'm not sure if I call people to action. I think what I want to do really is for us to recognize that we are already acting in lots of ways. You know, that also things that we consider insignificant are very often the creation or the possible creation of a different world. I suppose what I'm trying to do is say, look, that the answer really lies with ourselves. It lies with ourselves Because the problem is not the corporations. The problem is ourselves. The problem is that on the one hand, we are creating capitalism. And on the other hand, we are also trying to do something else. We are creating capitalism because the fundamental problem is not actually capital. The fundamental problem is the labor that creates capital. If you think of these cracks, if you think of this breadth of the other possible world, or these different areas of breathing of the other possible world, then you can see really that they're distinguished by the attempt to create a different sort of activity, different sorts of relationships, different sort of logic. Okay. On the other hand, we know that we also labor. Most of us have to sell our labor power, our ability to work, to capital in order to produce things that will sell, or in order to promote in some way the conditions of capitalist reproduction. Okay, so we're kind of caught by this bifurcation, if you like, of this antagonism between capitalist labor, the labor of actually producing and reproducing capital on the one hand, and developing an activity that makes sense to us on the other hand. So the way I see the possibility of change, and the way in which I see what's happening at the moment, is in terms of a revolt of doing against labor. I think more and more over the last 15, 20 years, we have come to understand that the struggle against capital is not the struggle of labor against capital. It is, in fact, the struggle against the labor that produces capitalism. In other words, the struggle is to reject the sort of activity that produces the corporations, that produces, of course, the weapons, that produces commodities, and to try and develop an activity that simply that has sense for us, I think. It's an activity that we consider useful or necessary. And I think we're all in that. I mean, you're producing and the host of this program, but you're doing it because this is an activity that has sense to you. Now, I'm a university professor. Okay, in that sense, I sell my labor power and I get paid for it. And I have to go through certain hoops that I hate. But I also try and develop my activity in a way that makes students critical, in a way that I enjoy, in a way in which the focus of teaching and of learning really becomes the question of how we can move on, how we can overcome capital. I assume that all our listeners are caught in this sort of antagonism that actually cuts through us. I mean, we are schizophrenic just by the fact of living in an antagonistic society. We are schizophrenic. So the question of how we strengthen the cracks is the question of how do we strengthen our own doing against labor? How do we actually turn our activity more and more against labor? And that actually takes us into a whole, I mean, part of the argument is that labor brings with it all sorts of things, historically and logically, that labor, or what Marx calls abstract labor, capital-producing labor, brings with it a certain sort of form of sexuality, a certain form of relation to nature, a certain concept of time, a certain certain forms of organization. And that if we try to break that, as we are doing, if we break with that, then what we do is we develop other forms of sexuality, other forms of relation with nature, other concepts of time, other forms of organization. And I think that's what's happening in the anti-capitalist movement at the moment, that there is a kind of a deep shift taking place. And the deep shift is actually has as its axis the rejection of labor and the understanding of anti-capitalism, not as the struggle of labor, but the struggle of a different type of activity, a central point of that is the question of time. Capitalist labor is really tied up very much with the notion of clock time, that the idea that time is something outside us, that time is something that moves forward independent of our activity. And that is what gives us the idea that capitalism exists from one day to another to another. Whereas really the problem is to break that concept of time and to understand that, no, time is not independent of our activity. Capitalism does not have any duration. It does not exist outside our activity. If capitalism exists today, it's not because it was created 100 or 200 years ago. If capitalism exists today, it is because people are producing it today. So that means that the question of revolution, the question of how to break with capitalism, it's not the question of how do we break, how do we abolish something that exists. It is really the question of how do we stop producing capitalism? How do we stop making capitalism? And the only way in which we can stop making capitalism is by creating something else. And I think that it may sound a very roundabout or complicated way of saying it, but I think that's actually what's happening. It's really this awareness that it's not the question of building up the great organization. It's not a question of overthrowing the state. That's not revolution. Revolution is actually saying, well, no, we're not going to act in that way. We're not going to labor. We're not going to structure our activity from one day to another in terms of the needs of capital. We are going to do something else. We're going to stop making capital.
For people listening to this, you know, it seems like an alien idea to consider that we create capital by becoming commodified units ourselves, right? By allowing ourselves to become just another form of commodification, the way we made our life available and act in the workplace without a connection to how that impacts all the other aspects of our lives. The Industrial Revolution had this many ideas that, you know, it will bring us leisure, that with all this technology that people would work less. But you're right. Instead, we are producing more. We're constantly producing more that feeds and maintains the structure of capitalism. How can people access your book?
People in charge of the distribution are Fernwood Books.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much for being with us today, John. John Holloway is my guest. He is the author of many books, including, well, his book, Change the World Without Taking Power, Zapatista, Rethinking Revolution in Mexico and Global Capital, National State and the Politics of Money, and his latest book, Crack Capitalism. Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you very much indeed, Sylvia.
Take care.
Thank you.
We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.